Are we allowed to enjoy this?
Keane O'Mahony is literally an opposition scrum half's nightmare.
People say I refereed lots of matches when I actually played.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
All right, there's only a week or so of us mowing left, but you're very welcome along. And if you'd like to get in touch with us this morning, show us your mows. If you're getting involved, then tweet us at OffTheBallAM with your mows, and we'll bring the best ones to air tomorrow as they right the wrongs of the previous week's judging in who has the best mow. I think who did the Tiger King Photoshop job?
I think it was Joseph. Was it?
Was it?
Did a pretty good job.
Okay.
Right,
it was Jojo.
Oh, it was Jojo. Sorry, was it?
Was it? Okay. You did the Tiger King. Yeah, okay.
Oh, it's Jojo. Sorry, apologies.
We're on to you, right? We know he's obviously on Adrian Barry's side. Frequently, Adrian will get an extra point in the quiz when Jojo's doing the ding. He's like, we were going to talk about that. Anyway, we got distracted. It was a big night last night in the Champions League. But if you do have a mo, share it with us. And you can definitely beat Adrian Barry's. And mine. Maybe Owen's.
What are you going to do with it tomorrow? You kind of like brought a different level of creativity every Friday morning. It's like, whoa, God, wow, when you send a photo in.
I don't know. I was going to do it this morning, and then I was like, I just don't have time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And we'll see if we can, I guess, issue a few bribes to get Adrian off the top of this list at the moment, because it's an absolute disgrace that he's up there.
There he is there, look.
What an absolute, like...
I mean, it definitely is next year's Halloween costume.
Oh my God,
it'll be just far enough from the original zeitgeist for it to be like Adrian doing the dad joke thing.
There could be an alternate reality where Adrian is an actor and just like gets a job as like one of the ruffians in Ozark or something, and he shows up looking like that. He's like, "Come here, I'm going to steal your truck." And I would believe him because he's got the facial expression for it, and he's certainly got the facial hair for it.
Yeah, yeah, he can, and he's got the accent too when he wants to. It's 7:32 this morning here on OTB AM. We're live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Let's talk about Manchester City last night. There are some other things that we're going to get to. Will we talk about Manchester United? We're getting the very latest from the Manchester Evening News. Their chief football writer has some very interesting details about some tactical stuff that was going on behind the scenes that Solskjaer might have vetoed, and also the latest on the runners and riders now for the actual interim as opposed to the interim to the interim. But Man City against the Mbappe, Messi, Neymar trio last night. I mean, it was very interesting to watch how the match evolved, and the screaming of the centre backs at Paris Saint-Germain in particular when they were under the caution that first half. They like, "Come back on the field," kind of stuff that you would tend to see at under 10s and under 12s when there is like the lad who can solo and who therefore thinks, "Well, I'm not doing any defending. I'm the full forward and they're going to get me the ball because I can solo the ball more than once without it careering off my shin." And the like big burly centre back who'd be shouting at him, "Come back and defend!" And Messi, Neymar and Mbappe is like, "Nah, no, no." I mean, the game doesn't matter that much, right? It matters a bit, but not that much.
No, it doesn't matter enough, yeah.
Like, that's the thing. There wasn't enough jeopardy on the line for the three lads to be totally up for it. And yet they were still very good. Like, Neymar should have scored after an amazing bit of trickery and one of those 1-2s that isn't really 1-2 but ended up being one with Di Maria, and then, you know, he's laughing with Gabriel Jesus afterwards. The interview is, "Oh, you won the game against your great mate Neymar," and he's like, "Yeah, he's my mate. I mean, we're international teammates. He's not just, you know, he's a real human being, Neymar, and so therefore we have had conversations and we played together, so yes, we are mates." Like, it's not that big a deal, but it seems to be a big deal. All the stars were out, is how it was. It didn't feel like it was. It felt like theatre last night as opposed to a match.
Yeah, all the stars are here would have been maybe the Norm MacDonald introduction to the game last night. You're right, the jeopardy does kill it. It does kind of take away from what would have been like an unbelievable knockout tie, for example, or even like a two-legged affair. It did feel at a point last night that it was going to go the exact same way as the first game, where you're like, Manchester City have a bit of control here and it's going to be reflected in the scoreline, and then boom, back at the net for Paris Saint-Germain. And it's like, right, is this the not that it matters overly, given the result in the Leipzig game. The result was never going to matter. But you started to think, is this actually the one failing of this Pep team, where they have a lot of the ball and they have a lot of opportunities and they still can't put a team away? So to come from 1-0 down to actually to put them away eventually, I think is a bit of a statement from Manchester City last night. I'd say in a lot of people's eyes they would be favourite now to actually get over the line and get this thing done this year. It, like, you can't see this Paris Saint-Germain team winning the Champions League, and you can see them winning you could actually see them winning like a one-off tie against Man City potentially, or even Bayern Munich, but to actually do it round after round after round, suspect that they are going to get caught at some point. Now, to bet against Messi, Neymar and Mbappe is obviously quite a silly thing to do, but it just feels that we've seen enough in even just in the context of last night and throughout the season so far,
I'm throwing out last night in some respects, and apart from the fact that like they did absolutely kill them in the first half and couldn't score, what's that about? Was it, okay, you've got world class defenders nipping the ball off the line, is that what it is about, or is that actually that they don't have the super ruthless goal scorers that you need to be champions of Europe?
As in Manchester City?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like I mean,
until they do it, they haven't done it. And so, you know, everybody's a doubting Thomas. And you put your hands in the wound, and the wound is that they don't have a number nine who they trust. Like, but I mean, Jesus was pretty good. He was causing trouble before the goal.
But he's like, I mean, Pep clearly still doesn't trust Gabriel Jesus.
No.
Everything he said about him this season has sounded good, but the actual process of giving him minutes at the most meaningful times hasn't happened. So he's talked the talk when it comes to Jesus quite a lot, but he hasn't actually trusted him as much as what his words would suggest. Like, it does come back, like it is that same issue. Like, what was the problem last year against Chelsea? And it's maybe Raheem Sterling not taking that early opportunity in the Champions League final. And those are the sort of moments that you need to be taking in a final. But it was a very Manchester City failing. It is clutching at a straw completely with this Man City team. But because they are striving for perfection and striving to win every single thing, it's a pretty glaring weakness that is probably going to come up again, I guess, at times. But that being said, I think I really do think people will be looking at these as Champions League favourites, and if they can iron that out, of course they're probably going to go all the way and win this thing. That is the quality that they have. So it's an issue. Like the front three last night, Mara, Silva, Sterling. If that was the starting front three in a Champions League final, you wouldn't be 100% sure that they would actually get the ball in the back of the net. But there's no doubting their unbelievable quality to create opportunities to do so.
And the strength and depth they have of those type of players now means that they are capable of finding people in form no matter what happens. If two of those are out of form, then your hope would be that Grealish is in form and or somebody else, Foden, is in form. It's like, okay, all right, they are going to definitely be at that level, which can be explosive. You just want to make sure that somebody has taken the responsibility to be the one who's going to like absolutely hammer it into the net, as opposed to, I'm going to pass it up against the upright, or I'm going to clip it off this guy's head. And then there's just a little bit of doubt, because there isn't a cold-blooded killer whose job it is to score 60 goals this calendar year.
Yeah, I would contend, though, it's like the one area where they possibly just don't have enough depth. Like, obviously, Cole Palmer starts in the centre of the attack at the weekend against Everton, I'm sure. I mean, like, it's a great opportunity to get those players in when you're playing with 10 Premier League winners, essentially, and a top quality team on that front. But still, is that if they get an injury crisis late on in the season, that's the level that they go to for somebody who's going to be getting meaningful minutes. Like the Grealish thing's been interesting. Like as somebody who obviously was attached to him so much at Aston Villa, like he must be looking at him at the moment thinking, I mean,
can we get him back for 50 million?
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Or like he will obviously come good at some point or another. But at the moment, it's not looking like. It's not looking like an amazing run so far from it at Manchester City.
No, it's not. And
we'll have to see when he comes back, obviously.
The people are pointing out that similarly, attacking players have had difficulty bedding into the system that Guardiola wants for you. And I don't know. I'm sure every opportunity exists for him to work out the current kinks, but maybe he doesn't. You know, maybe he is a 100 million quid bust, and then he can come back to Villa for what do you offer at that point?
You would actually be looking into getting him back?
25 million. Just test their resolve. Look, it's a bust, you know? Money doesn't really matter that much to you.
Like, what's going to happen here is that Grealish will eventually break out at Manchester City and have an amazing half season or whatever, where he's in contention for a Golden Boot, or like it might be next season or whatever.
Or it's after Christmas. It's like, yeah, I bet it in. I finally understand exactly what it is. I was living in a hotel and now I've got my own gaff. Whatever the issues are, maybe he's living in his own one. It looked like there was a power struggle last night, so shifty lad. About the big three and who could do the most while doing the least. Hate that, as I was a pretty bad defender. And Jack Reaper says, morning lads, some fantastic game last night in the Oil Derby. In fairness, it was brilliant. The quality of football you were watching was brilliant. It just didn't feel like there was enough on the line for it to matter that much. I haven't said that when the head was keeping the ball out. You were like, ooh. It was definitely the quality is sensational.
It was kind of like a nice sort of a scene setter of an episode at the start of a great run of TV shows or something. It's just like, this is clearly high quality, but it's not high stakes, and we're okay with that. Like we can't be getting wound up too much about that. We all know that the Champions League just goes to a whole other level after Christmas, and that's when the real business begins. And chances are we could see these two teams squaring off again later on in the competition, and it'll be so much better on that occasion. Like, it felt really dramatic the last time they met last season in the semi-final, wasn't it? So that's when the real business begins. But like, I can't even remember at the moment, but isn't the plan for the Champions League to expand the group stages? Or is it to expand the knockouts? I can't remember. But either way, the group stages
are
fine.
It's a league group stage as opposed to... Yeah, it's like
we do not need that.
16 teams that end up meeting in there. Was that it?
It's like something convoluted like that. But I think the group stages, while they've thrown up some, I guess, great storylines here and there down through the years, the business doesn't begin till after Christmas, and it does feel strange that when you're talking about PSG against Man City, when it's this late on, when it's match day five, it's hard to read too much into it. So I guess that's a bit of a failing of the current structure. But the price price we'll get for that, or the thing we'll see in return for that, is just a brilliant knockout stages once again, no doubt.
Yeah, in fairness, the City bench last night wasn't particularly strong compared to some other benches that we've seen them have. I don't think it was even fully filled out, but the PSG bench last night was absolutely ridiculous. Donnarumma, Sergio Ramos, Verratti, Icardi, Di Maria, Danilo. It's not bad. Gini Wijnaldum. So
yeah, it's pretty.
I wouldn't be writing Paris Saint-Germain off on the basis of what I saw last night.
No, like I mean before the game, Guardiola. I think the headline even regarding Guardiola praises Pochettino as an elite manager despite lack of league titles. Like, in hindsight, it's kind of like, I mean, is this the sort of guy that Pep Guardiola would be pretty content to see at the other side of Manchester over the course of the next little while? Of course, he's an excellent manager, but is he actually on the level where he's going to be the cold-blooded killer that's going to wrestle a title back to Old Trafford?
Well, I think what we heard yesterday on the show was, yeah, this scenario is not his making. He doesn't want the team the way it is. And if he goes to Manchester United and can build a team with the money in the style of what he wants, then I think that would be something that would concern Guardiola, because he seems like a hard enough character, Pochettino. I think Pochettino would be a good manager. There would certainly be a vast improvement on what we've seen before, even with the existing players, although I think that he would probably show several of those players the door and kind of cycle through players quicker than we've seen. So let's wait and see. If you've got a view on that, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180, that's the WhatsApp number. You can always just leave a comment in the YouTube stream. We're reading those and keeping an eye on them across the morning. So here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock for you. We are going to speak with Shane Castles on Ireland's need for a statement stadium. What are the world's great statement stadiums? We'll ask him that in a couple of minutes' time. We're going to talk football with Samuel Lockhurst of the Manchester Evening News. James Scales is going to join us at 8:30 to talk about the great piece that Arthur James O'Dea wrote on the website. It's done amazing business, so most of you will have seen it at this point. But if you haven't, get onto the hurling section on otbsports.com and check it out there. We talk football with Phil Egan, the Republic of Ireland in action this evening against Slovakia. You've got to make sure that you wear pants that are not too big for you, because otherwise they slip down. That was Vera Powell talking about making sure you're wearing the right size underwear. And then Johnny Logan we're going to play out with Johnny Logan today, talking about his love for bows with Joe last night. You didn't see this?
I actually haven't seen this yet.
Let me get you the Vera Powell quotes, because I don't want to butcher them any more than I've already butchered them, but sometimes it's almost like she has a Google Translate going in her head, and And it's like, I'm going to, you know the way the Dutch are like very matter of fact? Just to like use the racial stereotyping that we always give out about the nationalistic stereotype. The Dutch seem pretty kind of straightforward in how they're going to talk to you about things. And so she was pretty straightforward about this. Oh, why is it not here? Oh yeah, Pow warns Ireland not to get caught with pants down. This is in Dan's piece. Can I use a Dutch expression? If you put on pants that are too big a size, they will go down to your ankles. If we act as if we are bigger than we are, we'll have a problem with coping with that. Don't let your jocks fall down around your ankles, Owen.
Yeah, don't get too big for your boots is the Irish translation of that one. Like it's that's an interesting subject.
They're very different sentiments though. You get too big for your boots split.
Yeah.
You wear underwear that's too big for you, you're left, you know, dangling in the wind.
You're left humiliated and exposed.
Exposed. I mean, you might be humiliated, I'm sure.
Yeah, either way, it's like it's an involuntary thing, I guess. Whereas maybe getting too big for your boots is a sort of, look, you saw this coming. Your feet got bigger and bigger and bigger and you did nothing to stop it. Whereas this is like, oh, no, I have these around my ankles.
The only thing that could actually make you get too big for your boots literally is like feeding yourself like one of those foie gras geese, you know? Like you're getting force fed to the point where
it just has nowhere to go. It just goes to the ankles.
Bursts, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, Ireland's national team is clearly doing one of the two things at the moment. Like, it's beating Finland, the footballing equivalent of eating foie gras and gorging on it.
See, we don't get to eat the foie gras. We're the geese that get force fed.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I see.
We're the ones. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen that, but they like open the gullet and shove stuff down it. That's how you get that's how their liver expands to the point to make it so tasty.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's grotesque.
It is. Yeah.
It's really grotesque. I hope you're all enjoying your breakfast this morning at 7:46. Apologies for that. That mental image, but yeah. So I don't know. It's an interesting. The Dutch, as I said, have interesting phraseology. If you put on pants that are too big a size, they will go down to your ankles.
Yeah, like I guess it's true. Are we getting too big?
We'll see tonight if they don't put in a good performance. But that's the manager's job, right? That's like the manager sets the tone, puts the culture in. Complacency can certainly seep in from the players, but the manager needs to spot that and make sure that it doesn't happen. So, Thiago scored last night for Liverpool. Liverpool fans, again, no jeopardy in that match. They were able to give players some extra game time. Alisson nearly made a mistake that caused a goal, but didn't. They got away with it. They win 2-0. Salah scores again. Do they need to rest Salah at the moment to like give him an opportunity, or is he on a, I want to win the Golden Boot, give me all the goals?
It definitely seems that way, doesn't it? Given some of the players he left out last night, obviously Van Dijk on the bench doesn't play, Trent Alexander-Arnold on the bench doesn't play, Henderson, Robertson both come off the bench. So and Fabinho obviously in that conversation as well. So the frontliners were given a rest last night, with the exception of Sadio Mane and Mo Salah, and then obviously Alisson and goals. And I'm not saying it's stat padding or anything like that, but there must be a situation where Salah's like, I just want to keep scoring. And when you're on a hot streak, you're on a hot streak. And to be honest with you, if you're looking at it cynically from Jurgen Klopp's point of view, you're like, well, you know what, yourself and Sadio, you're going to be gone at some point in the next little while. You're going to be gone, so I'm going to get as much as I can possibly get out of you over the course of the next little while, and you can go, I'm sure that's not what the conversation is, and I'm sure it's to do with Salah being like, I want to score goals and keep scoring goals, and Mane has been in okay form as well, and he wants to keep scoring goals, so that's obviously why it's been done. But he was really, really irked before the game about being questioned about the dead rubber last year when Jota got injured at the end of the Champions League group stages. So I think he would have been I'm not saying that he would have got bitten by any injuries or anything like that happening last night, but he's never got any issue with playing a pretty strong team, even though the team's already through to the next round.
And the controversy over his conviction around the sex tape didn't stop Karim Benzema from scoring last night.
No, Sheriff. I mean, it was good while it lasted, our interest in this geopolitical story in the far reaches of Europe, but it looks like that story will not carry into the knockout stages. Sheriff beaten 3-0 by Real Madrid last night. Karim Benzema, as you say, getting on the score sheet. I didn't see the full game, just kind of caught the highlights of this last night. I mean, it seemed that Sheriff had a couple of opportunities to actually cause Real Madrid a few issues. They had 12 shots actually in the game last night, but it looks like that's going to be all she wrote when it came to that group. So it's Real Madrid on 12 points, Inter on 10, and Sheriff on 6. So Sheriff will be in the Europa League if you want to keep that thing going over the course of Thursday nights for the next, whatever, 4 or 5 months.
A lot of love on my Twitter feed from football journalists for the job that Simone Inzaghi is doing as the manager of Inter at the moment, and they qualified in that group as well in second place, so we must do a piece on that to find out exactly what it is that has turned him into an excellent manager, because, you know, loads of those players, he's around the same age as some of those players who are trying to make it at the moment as managers, and seems to be doing quite a good job of it. At 7:50 this morning, again, OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. One of the other big stories this morning is a book that Eddie Jones has put out called Leadership, where he says that he doesn't think Mauro Itoje is captain material. Now, he does qualify with, I might be wrong about this, but Mauro is more internally driven, and he drives himself to high levels of performance as opposed to cajoling those around him. And so, therefore, he wasn't part of the leadership group that Eddie Jones turned to during last season's Six Nations when things went wrong. Maybe this is the type of tough love that a coach like Eddie Jones can get away with. Itoje's performances have also already been excellent. He did play a year in a lower division because of the scandal around the salary cap at Saracens. But I'm not quite sure telling your best player that he can't be the captain of his country is the best motivation. I do wonder about that. I do wonder if there might be... I do also wonder if Jones is not widely loved by the English media, and stories have come out about his backroom staff never lasting a particularly long time. If something like this might not be the stick that they used to beat him with and out the door a couple of years out from a World Cup, I don't know. I just wouldn't be terribly surprised if this didn't end well, the mid-cycle book that you put out because you said you would and you're still on the job, and it's like, well, you need to give us something good. Okay, the good stuff is Mauro Itoje is not captain material. How does Mauro Itoje feel about this? How does his teammates, how do they feel about this? I don't know, I'm not sure. Is there any other good stuff in the book?
There's a lot of other good stuff in the book. Now, the extracts are, there's some of it carried in the Telegraph this morning. That bit about Itoje isn't in the Telegraph here, so I can't read out the full piece. But it's like, I'd be kind of more on the side of things that is tough love from Jones to Itoje. If you're drinking the Eddie Jones Kool-Aid, that's certainly what you would say, and you would say it's a pretty effective psychological technique.
I might be wrong, but I'm not sure Mauro is a future England captain. He's going to be one of the great players, but Mauro's very inward looking. He drives himself rather than anyone else. He doesn't usually influence people off the field. Mauro might be able to develop this skill and relate to people even more effectively, but he has work to do here. He has the intelligence to do it, and so no door is closed to him. At the same time, no door is automatically open to him either. We'll just keep reviewing his role and his contribution and see where it slots into the process of the organisation. We've sent Mauro to acting classes, which is having a beneficial effect. He speaks more influentially now, and I'm hopeful he can develop more communication and leadership skills. Acting brings Mauro out of himself.
Hmm. Well, like, if you're asking yourself, why has he gone down this route? I think from this extract that I'm reading here, I mean, it does play into this idea that he tries to create this culture of discomfort. He's like, don't allow your staff or team to become comfortable. It's no bad thing to keep people on edge, that they try to do more. How do you instill this uncomfortable edge? That means the intensity rarely drops. And he talks about this idea of, like, sometimes it comes through the selection process. Some players will become complacent, while some will never fall into that hole. And like, he reckons that the reason why the All Blacks are so good is that they constantly have a feeling of discomfort in their own camp, and maybe that's what he's trying to stoke with that. Like, there's a couple of interesting anecdotes. He says that I'm not sure was it true his time in Japan, but he managed to forge a friendship with Tadashi Yanai, who is Japan's richest man. He is the owner of Uniqlo, which is number 3 in the world in fast fashion. So only Zara and H&M are bigger in the world of fast fashion than Uniqlo. This guy, Tadashi Yanai, inherited his company from his father. And Eddie Jones says, personally, I love the story of how he became successful. Tadashi's father owned a department store in Western Japan. It was a small and modest company. When he eventually took over from his dad and began running the store, the business blew up in a few weeks. Every employee in his area quit because he was too brash. Tadashi was driven, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do. I mean, ring a bell, anybody? I mean, like it's interesting. Like, I mean, the thing about it is that it's consistent, and like there are, you can see why he's saying what he's saying about Mara Toje from what he's illustrating here. The little sidebar here, which was the first thing that grabbed my eye because of the headline: how he beat the All Blacks thanks to a samurai sword. Of course, I mean, we don't need any tips on how to beat the All Blacks in Ireland at the moment. But if you were looking for tips, he's talking about the 2019 World Cup. If we're looking for tips on how to win a World Cup quarterfinal or how to beat the All Blacks in the World Cup, these are your tips. So 3 days before that semi-final in 2019 excuse me, I just
Eddie Jones, he's the ghost of Eddie Jones. He's on your shoulder.
I can't believe I bottled it.
He's got his hands around your throat.
I'm just not good enough. So 3 days before the World Cup semi-final on the Wednesday, I felt we weren't quite there in training. So I'm reading from the book here. We weren't sharp enough for the All Blacks, so I did something different that evening. I brought a samurai sword into the team room. It was impressive and authentic, and I'd spent a fair amount of money on it from an antique shop in Tokyo. I also brought in some kiwi fruit. You could say it was cheesy rather than fruity. But I used the samurai sword to side them in two. The blade was so sharp that the kiwi fruits split apart in an instant. "There you go, boys," I said. "See how we do it now?" The players were laughing, but a few of them shot me a look as if to say, "Shit, this guy's nuts." I still walked around the room with the samurai sword and made them all feel the deadly blade.
Feel my blade.
And then they came up
feel
with
my deadly blade.
Came up with the V formation, which was Owen Farrell's brainchild's. Oh, I'm sorry, no. Owen Farrell's the head of the V. Sorry, I don't know who came up with it. And they beat the All Blacks and they got to a World Cup final, and they ended up losing the World Cup final. But God, we would fight your hand off for an appearance in the World Cup final.
I mean, I can just imagine the pain of losing the World Cup final to South Africa. In order, Wales first, South Africa second, England third. That's my order.
I know it's the your order. Rankings. I know it's your order. Yeah, that's no surprise. Like, why Wales over South Africa?
What do you mean?
why not South Africa as number one? I guess.
Well, who are we closest to?
Yeah, true.
Who do we see all the time?
Yeah, well, like,
the great thing is South Africa haven't yet been admitted to the Six Nations. I mean, it looks like it's going that way. They're going to just boot Wales out at some point over, or not boot Wales, boot Italy out over the next decade or so. It's like, look, we literally did everything we could, and you couldn't even help yourselves. And look at these guys; they're good. You're not. So sorry about that. We like your hustle. That's why it's hard to cut you. We particularly like going to Rome. That's why it's very hard to cut you. But in the meantime.
Yeah, the only thing worse than getting beaten by Wales in a World Cup final would be getting projectile vomited on from two rows up by a flying human from Wales.
The metaphor, the reality, they're simpatico. They're the shaking hands emoji.
Yeah, that was 2011, I'm sure, was a pretty dark time to be you, because it almost very much almost happened.
Well, that was before I fully appreciated just how Welsh the Welsh fans were.
Why? When was the moment? When was your moment of realization?
Oh, it must be. It's really only in the last couple of years that we've got to this point, right?
You've got to the point.
It's 7:57 this morning. OTBM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. There is a conspiracy theory brewing in our YouTube comments this morning, and it's in connection with the difference between the treatment of Paul Pogba and Jack Grealish. Grealish can go in the bin, with Fabian Dalf, says Deja Dude. The lack of talk about the Grealish price tag, says John Donoghue, proves the Pogba witch hunt. The lack of talk about the Grealish price tag proves the Pogba witch hunt. So the implication twofold here. One, Pogba, the criticism of Pogba is motivated by something other than Pogba's performances, and two, Grealish is somehow being immunised from this. Maybe the two things are connected. So
Like one way or another, the thing is, the jury is still out on Jack Grealish. It hasn't gone well so far, and it's literally November.
Well, he hasn't really played that many games, right?
Yeah.
And so Pogba has played a lot of games for Manchester United over a number of years now, and there is no sustained period of 15 to 20 games where he has played to his full potential. And he's been given every opportunity to do so. They've built a team around him. They've used him as, okay, we're not building the team around you, so no pressure on you. We're putting you in your favourite position. We're going to move you to different positions. We're going to try literally everything we possibly can. And he has not performed. Manchester United should have sold him after the last tournament, when he played well, and that was a bit of interest in him. But instead, they decided that they were doubling down with the experiment, which is like it's definitely a multifactorial experiment, where the biggest part was Solskjaer and him being the constellation, or in the middle of the constellation that can keep these stars in the air. And they threw another one in Ronaldo, and it was like, I'm done. I am out of here. I can't do this anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, you're probably right in the 15 game a season thing. Like, obviously, the year before Liverpool won the Premier League, he was exceptional at times that season, and that was probably his biggest run of consistency. And that obviously makes what's happened more recently even more disappointing. Some of the performances for France make the whole thing even more disappointing. It's just there's just a much larger body of evidence from Paul Pogba recently than Jack Grealish to suggest that hasn't worked out. I would be surprised if Jack Grealish doesn't catch fire over the course of the next couple of seasons and the reaction isn't similarly, why the hell did they spend that much money on him? The fact of the matter is that he just hasn't had enough time to prove whether or not he's going to be a bust or not. And he was outstanding at Aston Villa last season and the season before. So there is enough credit in the bank recently in the very league that he's playing in to suggest that it could work out okay.
Okay, it's bang on 8 o'clock this morning. You're watching OTBAM on YouTube, perhaps. Make sure you subscribe, and anytime we go live, we'll send you a notification. Or maybe you're listening to us as a radio show on the OTB Sports app. You can also get us on your smart speaker, of course, if you just tell your smart speaker to play OTB Sports Radio. Now, Senator Shane Castles is on the line. He's a Fianna Fáil senator, and he's called on the government to build a signature stadium for the 2030 World Cup bid. Shane Castles, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. How are things?
It's Ger and Owen here, actually.
Ger, sorry.
No worries. No worries. Shane, you, I guess if you're saying we should build a stadium, we'll come to that in a minute, but you are an enthusiastic supporter of a bid for the World Cup. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I suppose the context of this is yesterday, the Minister for Sport, Jack Chambers, was actually before us at the Oireachta Sport Committee, and he was outlining the work that the department are doing, and he mentioned obviously the fact that we've been successful in getting the 2030 Cricket T20 World Cup to Ireland. And so in the course of that debate, he also mentioned the fact that, of course, the government are involved with a joint effort with the UK government in exploring the possibility of having the FIFA World Cup in 2030. So I just asked the question, first of all, how much are we actually spending so far on this bid? So the answer was €500,000. So in the context of, you know, a bid for the FIFA World Cup, that's relatively small money at this moment in time. And I just asked about the stadium infrastructure, the seriousness of our bid in that context, because we've been here before. You know, we remember that the efforts back in the early noughties to try and get the 2008 European Championships with the Scots to Ireland, and, you know, UEFA delegates on a bus going out to fields in the middle of nowhere looking at that. We've been here with the Rugby World Cup. So, I mean, this is only 8 years away, but in 2030, you know, our main stadium, and you know, we know what they are. Croke Park is going to be 35 years old by then. In fact, the Cusack Stand will be nearly 36 years old by then. The Aviva Stadium will be 20 years old. So I was just asking in the context of, like, is this the basis of our bid, or are we looking at providing a signature stadium as part of this bid? Or is it a case of just, you know, upgrading what we have? And I think that conversation has to happen hard and fast now, or really there's no point in going down this road again.
So, because the way the story is phrased is that you actually called on them to build a signature stadium, that you were behind that idea, as opposed to asking the question, should we build it?
Yeah, well, I think if we're serious about that bid, I think, it is something that should be considered, that we should look at having a signature stadium as part of that bid. Like, when we look at the stadiums that the UK are obviously going to put forward, and you look at the level of world stadiums are evolving all of the time rapidly. So you look at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
How much did that cost?
We're talking, I think that cost in the region of €1 billion to provide that. Obviously, that's private finance, and they're going to be paying for that for a long, long time.
Yeah, they're €800 million in debt at the moment on that stadium.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the point being is that, right, in terms of actually landing this, they are going to require stadiums of that magnitude. So the point being is we're either serious about this, we're either serious about providing a world event in this country,
okay,
or we're not.
Are we serious about? And so just to follow through your logic, right? So if we compare ourselves with Spurs, and we point out that Spurs are €800 million in debt because of the stadium, and if we're serious about it, we should walk ourselves into €800 million in debt to get a World Cup.
No, I'm not saying that. And Spurs are in debt for a whole lot of other reasons as well. But
they're not actually. They were very, very profitable. They made $200 million 2 years ago before the stadium. So they're actually in debt because of the stadium.
Exactly. But if you look at what the bid is, are we going to look at doing a serious upgrade, say, for example, Croke Park? Now, I made the point that only a few years ago, the GEA carried out an internal report and pointed to the fact that just to carry out the essential upgrades that are required at this moment in time, just for Croke Park as is, would cost $60 million. So, I mean, obviously, we're going to have to look at the kind of facilities that we'd actually have to put into Croke Park to actually bring it up to a standard required, not just on the actual internal aspects of the stadium, but the external aspects around the stadium as well. So obviously the bid and the money that they're spending at the moment is going to look at all of that. And that's going to be quite informative as to where our bid is going in this process.
Should we be bidding? Because it doesn't really seem to make that much sense for us to invest in stadiums when we have plenty of stadiums. We actually have too many stadiums in Ireland at the moment. And the whole notion that we would try and win a World Cup and use that as an excuse to build another stadium is madness, actually.
Well, that goes to the heart of the conversation. And that's why we were having that conversation yesterday in the committee. Should we be bidding at all? That's a fair question. And if not, should we go down the road again of what we did before?
No, let's not bid. Let's not bid. Why are we bidding?
No, that's the point. That's the conversation that we were having yesterday, Jared.
What do you think?
I think it is worthy of consideration. I mean, anytime we talk about spending money on sport in this country, I mean, a whole load of different plethoras of things will be thrown out to say, no, we shouldn't. I mean, there is a point.
Well, no one on this show is ever going to say we shouldn't spend on sport. We're the opposite.
No.
We just think it should be spent properly. And spending money on a stadium that is going to be largely a white elephant. What you're calling for is a signature stadium, which is a third major stadium, I presume in Dublin. Mm-hmm. Or in that area, who's going to be the tenant? When is it ever going to be full? Who's going to use that on a day-to-day basis?
And again, that's the conversation that has to happen now in terms of the major partners that would be in part of this, whether that be the IRFU, whether that be FEI, the GEA, in terms of utilising that. Because obviously there has to be a legacy. We've seen this with cities before in the Olympics, where the Greeks put themselves into massive debt and then they didn't have a proper legacy worked out after that. So that has to happen now.
Has anybody ever had a proper legacy worked out after Olympics?
But then, again, I mean, are we going to say then that there shouldn't be any world events, whether that be the World Cup, whether that be the Olympics?
Yes.
Of course,
Yes, we should never try and host a World Cup. We should never try and host an Olympic Games. It is a complete waste of money. It is the transfer of money from the taxpayer to massive multi-global sports organisations for no other reason than the vanity of politicians. That's what those events are about for the local people. There is no legacy that anybody can ever point to from any major tournament in anywhere in the world that has done anything other than enrich FIFA or UEFA or the International Olympic Committee. That is all this is.
Okay, well, I think that there was a lot of disappointment from a lot of fans that we didn't, because of COVID, actually get to play our part in the European Championships.
So that was three games. I'm all in favour of three games, right? But this is different. You're talking about building a stadium. We already established the stadium. The first stadium you compared it to was an £800 million white elephant.
Yeah, now let me finish the point. I'm not saying that we have to build a stadium of that magnitude, okay? Because, I mean, as part of the bid, we have to look at what our requirements would be. Remember, the UK are leading the charge in this. So as part of that work, we have to say, well, what would be the requirements on us? What is the kind of type of stadium? Because obviously we're not going to be hosting the final or the semi-finals, okay? So we have to look at what our part in this would be. And that would inform then the type of stadium. So that doesn't mean you're building the €800 million euro stadium. It could be significantly less than that. So we have to look at what would be required as part of that bid, which is what this money is being spent on at the moment. The point I was saying before you came in there was that there were a lot of sports fans, a lot of football fans who were disappointed that we didn't get the opportunity to host those three games. So I think it's not a case of the vanity of politician or the vanity of the Blazers and sports organisations. There is a huge benefit, not just socially, economically as well. The FAI themselves, we had Paddy Bonner in here last week talking about the social and economic gains of the game in the country. So it is wider.
No. That's an excellent point. Hang on a second. That's exactly the point. Paddy Bonner was in last week talking about the benefits to our health policy, our education policy, our social policy,
and
you're not investing.
And our economic policy.
Okay, Grant. You're not investing in the things that will actually help that. What you're saying is, let's build a stadium that will never be used. How often is Parc et Quay full?
Yeah, so
how much government money went into that?
No, you skipped over a point.
I didn't.
There was a whole section on the economy in that report last week.
On the benefits to the economy. On the benefits to the economy, not from stadiums. And I'm saying you're coming on, you're using the one bit of platform that you have to say, let's build a stadium to try and get a World Cup. Instead of actually saying, last week we had Paddy in, if we spent that money and all the money that we're going to invest in this, because it's not only 500 grand, let's wait and see what happens. The 500 grand comes back and they go, yeah, we've got a chance of getting it. Let's go. And all of a sudden, the blood is up of a bunch of politicians who know that they're going to get on TV and that they're going to get airtime saying, yeah, we're going to need a stadium here. This is going to be great for us. When actually what you should be doing is saying, let's invest in coaching and let's invest in diversity projects and let's invest in changing rooms for all the clubs around the country who are changing in trailers at the moment, because politicians have always used sport as a little football to get on the TV to build vanity projects instead of investing in their local communities.
Okay, well, a couple of things there. The rest of that committee meeting yesterday actually did touch on that in terms of those facilities that are required. And in terms of me as a politician, I am hugely invested in sport here. I was a sports journalist for 20 years. I stood on plenty of sidelines, on plenty of pitches, covering soccer, GAA, rugby, cricket. So, to throw the remark at me in terms of being a politician and using sport, I was in sport long before I was a politician,
the worst thing we could do is build another stadium that's never full.
No, but it goes to the heart of the matter. Should we be getting... You're after answering the question. You don't think we should. You think we should scrap the idea. I'm saying, no, there are benefits to actually getting the FIFA World Cup here as well. But we have to be honest with each other in terms of, if we are serious about doing it, well, then we need to make sure we have a bid and a stadium that actually can win. Otherwise, let's forget it now and not do it.
If we imagine the signature stadium, what does that look like in your head? Where does it exist? How many seats is it? How much will it specifically cost? Because I don't think you've actually specifically said that this morning.
No, but again, that goes to the point of the report in terms of what our role in this with the UK, and that's being obviously explored at the moment in terms of, right, are we looking at what we required from us? Is a 40,000-50,000 euro, a 40,000-50,000 capacity stadium in terms of then the planning process? Imagine we're only 8 years away from this. So, I mean, if we are going to be actually serious about this and need it in terms of the planning process, that would have to be instigated, you know, very, very soon in terms of identifying with whether that be Dublin City Council or Fingal County Council, because if you're looking at North Dublin, West Dublin, that area, in terms of actually developing that. So those conversations would have to happen very, very soon in terms of actually progressing that.
So I'm just trying to get the picture in your head. So you think this is a stadium out in Fingal, North County Dublin?
No, I didn't say that. That's the point. I'm saying that if the report, in terms of working with the UK government, in terms of what our requirements would be, and they set out, as part of this bid, what our requirements would be, well then, knowing the planning process, knowing that what we'd have to do, that conversation would have to start very, very soon in the early part of next year.
I guess I'm just asking, just theorising, when you actually throw out the idea of a signature stadium, what are you thinking? Like, feel free to throw it out there. Like, what's your vision in your head when you say that yesterday?
Yeah, but again, it goes to the point in terms of what I'm saying in terms of, we look at the world stadiums, we look at the manner in which they evolve, the facilities that they have, what would be required in 2030, which is nearly a decade away. And if we look at the existing infrastructure that we have, that we're probably premising the base or the base of the bid on, which is a stadium like Croke Park, which is, as I said, by then, the Cusack Stand, which was phase one of that development, will be 36 years old, which needs remedial work as things stand. And it can be. I'm not saying that can't be done. We looked at the German bid, which was successful before, and they went and they remodeled the Olympic Stadium. So it can be done. I'm not saying that can't be done at all. But then we need to make sure and get that analysis done very, very quickly.
we did a piece recently with Peter McKenna for Science Week, and he made the point that actually if you look at World Stadium, since the Coliseum, things haven't changed that much. There's a central pitch and then there's a big area around them. And now, obviously, he knows more than anybody else the speed at which things evolve and the science of being able to watch replays and being able to get food and all that kind of stuff. But like the stadiums we have at the moment are grand, and actually they're never full. So Croke Park is full twice a year. The Aviva is full maybe twice a year on the years where maybe three times a year. They couldn't sell it out for Japan. They couldn't sell it out for Argentina even after that. The football team, you hope, will start to fill it a bit more often, but there's no guarantee of that. And so what we're suggesting as a country is that we need to look into and spend a lot of time thinking about whether or not we should build a third stadium to make Gianni Infantino and his cronies think, oh, geez, the Irish, they're great lads. This all seems like a waste of political time and capital, and when we should be talking about more people participating in more sport more often. That's the fundamentals of what sport and sports policy should be.
So, I mean, on that basis, in terms of, you know, stadiums haven't changed, or it's a pitch and so forth, X, Y, and Z, we would never have redeveloped Croke Park in 1992-93. Would have said, it's fine, we'll leave as is. It's the two stands and the terraces will be fine. We'll just dicky it up and move on.
How do we do on Parc an Caoimhe? How successful a remodel, and how useful has that been?
Well, again, you know, I don't think that's a fair comparison, given that it was completed just at a time that we then entered into COVID as well. I think,
but it massively ran over before COVID.
I know, but now they can't
get planning permission for the car parks that they need, and the access to it isn't great.
Okay, well, I think again, I think Parc an Caoimhe will prove its worth. I think it is a fine stadium. The issues with the planning that you mentioned, I think, will be ironed out. That was just a case of Cork County Board, you know, maybe should have gone back in terms of the pre-planning, engaging with Cork City Council. I think they will get that planning for what's required, and I think that will wash its own face.
How often is the Gaelic grounds full?
The Gaelic grounds in Limerick or the Gaelic grounds in Drogheda, Ger?
Well, the one in Limerick, yeah. It seems like almost never. Was it full for the Mayo Kerry game that time, or nearly full? Yeah. It was close enough to it. My point is that we have massive amounts of stadiums in this country at the moment that we can't fill all the time. So let's build another one.
Okay, and that's a fair point in terms of, you know, I've seen top journalists like Martin Brettany, you know, do an analysis on this before in terms of whether we should just go towards regional venues rather than a multiplicity of venues. And that's something that I actually made the point in yesterday in terms of the sports capital grant scheme itself, which is going to be announced in just a few weeks, which goes to the heart of the points that you're making in terms of investing in sport. Okay, so if we're going to be honest in terms of sports policy and how we're investing our money, we actually have the lunacy of the situation across numerous towns and villages in this country where GAA, soccer and rugby pitches all side by side will all apply to the sports capital grant, not get the best bang for the buck, for our buck. And the point I was making last week, which is actually a point I made with Liam Gogarty last week from the FEI and UEFA, was that if we did go towards the European model of municipal grounds, we could get far better return on the money that we're investing. As things stand, it's around 40, 50 million euro a year in the sports capital grants. And I think we can get far better bang for our buck if we actually go towards that municipal stadium model. And I made the point that that requires getting Tom Ryan, getting Philip Brown, getting Jonathan Hill into the room together and say, guys, are we going to move towards that model? Are we just continuing on the path of all three pillar sports organisations just still going on in and applying for their own grants and maybe not getting the best return?
If you spend your time lobbying for that, I will support you 100%.
But what
ends up happening is if we go down and spend a lot of time as a country thinking about trying to host major events, the effort, and so it's an opportunity cost for the organisations. They don't have the manpower or the bandwidth to apply for these massive international tournaments and do all the glad handling and the politicking that needs to be done, while at the same time coming to a massive seismic shift in how we think about sport. So if you engineer social and sports policy in that direction, Shane, you've got the full support of, I think, I would say, most people in the country. But if we start spending our time trying to build another white elephant, another birdie ball, whatever it is, then, like, no, you can't have that. I can't...
Okay. And can I just say on that point, and this is maybe just in terms of what gets covered in here, That was a point I probably spent more time talking about yesterday, but that didn't get covered. That wasn't picked up on, making that point, because I actually spoke to the FEI officials after, and in the week after that launch last week, and actually made that point that I would argue for that, because they are very, and also the fourth pillar in that as well, in an organisation that I've dealt with a lot, is Athletics Ireland. I know in my own hometown of Navan, where Park Villa, who play in the Leinster Senior League, play their games, it's we have a €1 million athletics track for Navan Athletics Club surrounding that as well. That is the model that we should be looking at and trying to actually invest in. So that point was made forcefully by me yesterday, and actually trying, and in fairness, I made that point to the minister. I said, should we just break the funding model that we have as is and actually move towards that type of model in terms of the collaboration of all the pillar sports and municipal stadiums like they have in Central Europe? And he said that was something that they would look at and try and get better collaboration. As I said, that was actually a lengthy conversation, but that wasn't picked up by anybody.
Shane, you mentioned there a moment ago that you do think there are real benefits to hosting a World Cup here. And as you say, the cost of hosting a World Cup here for that signature stadium alone will be somewhere between, say, €500 million and £1 billion. So taking that into account, what are those benefits that you see of hosting a World Cup here?
And again, so in terms of when they did the bid for the Rugby World Cup, and they presented that to not just the IRFU, but also in terms of to the government, because they acted as a backer of that as well. That's what this report would actually spell out. So in terms of what it would cost and what are the economic benefits as well, it may be the case that when that report is published, that the option of going down and building a signature stadium is taken off the table, and they say, no, there isn't an economic benefit to doing this. And if that's the case, well, then you accept that and you say, that's fine. You look at the actual infrastructure we have and the upgrading of that. How much is that going to cost? You know, I think you're definitely looking at a couple of €100 million anyway. If the price tag, which was done a few years ago, so the cost has gone up. I think that was done in 2016. The analysis was done in Croke Park. It was €60 million in 2016. You know, so 4 or 5 years later, what's the price tag now? And what would the price tag be to bring it up to standard required for 2030? You could be getting into the €200 million mark anyway, in terms of the upgrades. So in terms of the cost-benefit analysis and what's required, the report's going to set that out. If that says no, take the signature stadium off the table, that is lunacy. Of course you accept that. But if they say, in terms of the economic gain to the country, is X, Y, and Z, and the figures stack up, Jerry's made the point that he says, no, it's never stacked up in any other city, in any other host city, well, then you accept that.
But you said there are benefits earlier. You said there are benefits to hosting a World Cup. So what are they?
Of course, there's economic benefits in terms of the spend. We know what the spend is on every single Six Nations game and what the spend is to Dublin City Centre in terms of hospitality, in terms of hotels, what that brings in terms of VAT revenue. We know the social benefits to cities as well, and bringing foreign tourists in.
And like, do you think that's worth? I mean, of course, there needs to be more research done into the exact figures, but do you think that that's worth the €500 million to €1 billion? Like, just if we're saying that that's the figure, do you think that's worth it?
Well, again, the report would point to what the economic benefits is. You know,
what do you reckon? What do you think?
You both know from going to away games for either the soccer or the rugby, you can't put a pure economic benefit. There is an intangible social benefit to hosting something as well.
And like, benefits?
You know that as sports fans, what that brings, the actual, just the bond of people, bringing people to a city, the bond of people. It's what makes sport. We knew it when we didn't have, when COVID came. We missed it when we didn't actually get to
can you just explain that, the tangible social benefit that you mentioned there?
The sheer joy of having people in your city from other countries for hosting a world event. The sheer joy I know I get when I go to see Ireland play abroad.
And is that worth half a billion to £1 billion, do you think?
But then there you go. That we're again a sports fan saying, well, no, we're never going to play our role on the world stage in that respect, because we just think it's too much money and we'll never go there. If that's the case, well, then let's scrap the conversation and we'll never have the conversation again.
Okay.
The conversation has obviously come back up again. It may be the case that it may be the case that no, it's not a runner, and let's just forget about it.
But let's
be honest, though, you know,
this is Boris Johnson's flight of fancy, and we are absolutely helping him to go, I'm delivering a World Cup for London, for the UK, and we're like, yeah, we'll prop you up, no problems. And it probably suits the FAI, in fairness, because it helps them to get friendlies from England when they need them, and you know, there's definitely a connection there. And I understand from the FAI's perspective why they would try and reassert themselves on the global stage and get reintroduced into rooms that they haven't probably been in since John Delaney. I understand from their perspective what the involvement should be. But the Irish government should be saying, I'm sorry, but we are not going to help Boris Johnson at this moment or his successor to deliver some kind of weird Tory triumph. Because that's what we're doing. We're propping up Boris Johnson. We are an enabler of Boris Johnson in this process. And that doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay, well, I don't think anyone in of any party would trying to be facilitating a flight of fancy by Boris Johnson. I'm not too sure I'm not too sure he's too many fans around here. But, you know, the point is that there is now going to be a report commissioned or is underway. We'll see that when it comes out. As I said, if it is a case that it points to an upgrade of existing stadia, but then we have to be serious. Is that going to be good enough? And what that upgrade is going to be? Okay, so I mean, in terms of... Let me finish the point, because the stadium that we have are okay for the domestic sports that we have.
Yeah,
We looked at this before in terms of the Rugby World Cup, where we think the stadiums we have are fine, and they are for what we have to do. But in terms of then what's required, even going down to things like, you know, media centres, international media, what they're required in terms of a press box. You guys know from stadiums around the country, and I've been in most press boxes in the grounds around this country, some of them are like chicken coops. They're not a whole lot better. So, I mean, in terms of even just that basic principle of what would have to be spent to upgrade them is significant.
Yeah,
and so we have to be serious about this in terms of, right, are we actually going to go and do this properly?
No, hopefully is the answer. I would, and I hope that people will make their own minds up about whether or not this is a flight of fancy. Okay. One last thing, I think today there's more conversation around sports capital grants. Is that correct? Is there another hearing today for the sports committee?
No, we're not in hearing today. But I did ask the minister yesterday in terms of how much additional money is actually going to be put in, because in the budget, the Minister for Public Expenditure, Michael McGrath, had said in his budget speech he was going to make more money available. There's around 200 million euros worth of grant applications that have come in. So we want to try and make sure, you know, this is a problem for sports clubs. A lot of clubs will put an application in. They might get some money, but then they don't get enough and it doesn't allow them to actually get the project off the ground. The large-scale infrastructure grants that came out just before Christmas 2019, there were some 36 projects that actually got granted, like Connacht Rugby got granted. My own grant in Appin Park, Carlton got granted. A huge amount of them, I think 90% of them or more, haven't actually started construction yet.
Okay, because of COVID. I totally understand that. Sorry, I was maybe there's something else happening today, but the spend on the Ryder Cup is something that comes up, or the spend on, for example, the yacht race that was mooted last year. Should we be spending money to bring the Ryder Cup to Ireland, or is that something that actually private benefactors who are going to benefit from it the most should foot the bill for?
Well, I mean, I suppose we, you know, we've seen the benefit of when we had events in the K Club and so forth before.
Did we?
I mean, again,
did we see the benefit of that?
Again, but then again, that goes down to in terms of actually doing these reports in terms of, right, what was the spend by international visitors? You know, they do reports beforehand, they do reports afterwards. Okay. What was the spend by international visitors?
And it'll be interesting to see exactly what the benefit of L7 was. So that's a fair point. Shane, you've been good with your time. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Enjoyed it, guys. Enjoyed it. Take care.
Senator Shane Castle's there giving us his thoughts on a signature stadium for our World Cup bid. OTBAM with Gillette. Proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. We've got to take a quick break. We're going to be talking with James Scale. We'll obviously preview Ireland-Slovakia with Phil Egan, and we'll run you briefly through the sports pages, but we're talking hurling next.
OTB AM.
Slightly cranky OTB AM this morning at 8:30. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. The hashtag is OTB AM. Some of your comments coming through. Sorry, I'm going to tell you about this as well. We obviously have teamed up with Healthy Ireland to bring you our Let's Get Set. It's a how-to series helping you to lead a healthier lifestyle. That was Nora Stapleton in the ad break that you'll have heard there. For more information and easy-to-follow advice, see gov.ie/Let's Get Set. Exactly the type of initiative that we need to be investing in, as opposed to white elephant stadiums. As you can see, I'm not really in favour of bidding for massive, big ticket, shiny, fake scissors cutting of things to go, yay, look what I did. Look what I, an elected representative, and therefore you, I'm your proxy. Look what I achieved for my glory. I delivered the World Cup.
Or maybe you just don't like nice things, Ger.
I mean, I love nice things. I love nice things. I would love it if we knocked all the stadiums that we had and built one super amazing, gleaming
signature stadium.
Yeah, like, like, you know, the Mercedes-Benz Dome in Atlanta. You know, a 3 billion stadium with the biggest screens in the world. Yeah, let's go for it. But who's paying for it?
Don't we have that in Connacht already? The Mercedes-Benz Dome.
The dome, we do, the biggest dome. Davey Beats, a simple answer. We don't bid for the World Cup. The country needs a lot more than another chucking stadium. Surely the Department of Sports could spend the money better to develop grassroots sports. Many of our Olympians train overseas, but we need another football stadium. Isil Cody says, ah, Ger, I'd say the London Olympics left a great legacy. The more they tested samples years later, the more of a legacy is left. But apart from that, couldn't agree more with your sentiment on it. Mark Maloney says, for crying out loud, would we not be better off making sure that our League of Ireland clubs all have proper facilities first and then build this vanity project? See, the thing about this is you don't have to deal with the issues around grassroots sport and coaching and shared facilities and all that kind of stuff if you're always constantly looking towards the next project 10 years down the line. It's like a brilliant distraction where, oh, we're going to get the World Cup, and then you don't get the World Cup, but you've spent 4 years talking about getting the World Cup and all the time and effort and money and political and social capital that you can use, instead of like the under-8s don't have floodlights on because there's no money to turn the floodlights on a Monday and a Wednesday, so that to train beside the seniors so that there's a bit of overspill of light, which is happening in clubs all around the country. There's no basketball hoops in most schools in the country because the Basketball Ireland can't afford to give a grant to all the schools to have them, which they, you know, Ireland indoor, the weather not great always. Wouldn't it be amazing if everybody, all the kids, but no, let's spend 800 billion on a stadium that look cool, and then we can have three empty stadiums 900 of the thousands whatever days a year. More than that. So anyway, look, give us your views. This is an open forum. It is 8:33 this morning. Okay, sorry, very quickly. As an architect, I would say stop building new stadiums. We need to stop thinking more and new is better. It no longer works in the modern world / climate. Brown is in favour of the new stadium. Am I the only one that would love an 80,000 seater slap bang in the middle of the country where the GAA soccer and rugby could use the Hill of Tara Stadium? Not quite the middle of the country, but anyway. Do multinational sports competitions not make a rake of money for the hosting countries? No, they don't. Absolute nonsense. Building another stadium is just a vanity project. Build grassroots infrastructure and sports first. This hasn't gone well. Ger has just had an all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet. We don't need another stadium. The money should go in grassroots sports and not even the main pillars across all sports. Facilities always need upgrades. And then he's tagging one of his mates. That's Foz Valdo.
An all-you-can-eat buffet. Like, when I first saw that comment written down, I was like, are you trying to suggest that, like, Ger is cranky when he's not hungry? And then I got what he was trying to say. A bit slow this morning.
It is Thursday morning. It is OTBAM and it's 8:34 and we're turning to something wholesome. It's hurling and James Scale is with us this morning. James, good morning to you. How are you?
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Arthur James O'Dea wrote a brilliant piece at the weekend talking about your battle for the number one jersey in Galway hurling over the best part of a decade, and it just had loads of details in it that I never heard and never knew and never fully understood exactly the level that yourself and your colleague / rival went to get the number one jersey, and so we just thought it would be good to tease it out and just live a little bit of the experience with you. When you got into the Galway setup, how long did it take you to become the established number one? What age were you?
I Stuart Nan called me in his first year in like October 06, so I was just out of minor. We temporarily beaten us in the final in September, and so I went in 06 and started training away, and we did all the doggery training, you know, terrible training that's kind of synonymous now with looking at his tenure in Galway. But so basically, when I first got in rightly, my first year was only kind of a bedding in period, you could say, you know what I mean? And then I got the jersey in 2008, so I would have been 20 when I got it. And then Cullum came in 07 as well, the kind of last stage of 07. He was the goalie in 07. And I had never known Cullum, didn't know he existed. And then he came in and thought, Jesus, who's this lad? Do you know what I mean? Pretty good, do you know what I mean? And then we just started contesting from there on. So I'd say from from really and truly from 2008 onwards when the battle started.
Are you roughly the same age?
No, I'm 33. Colm is about 30. Oh, God, I hope I get this right. 38.
Right.
39. So, he's going to shoot me.
Nearly 40. You may as well. Late 30s. You get away with that these days. And so, because we've talked to you before about, like, you know, stuff came easy to you early, and so did you just expect to be number one? When you got to number one, it was like, this is going to be fine. What was that like? What was that experience?
You see, I have to go back, but you have to understand, like, I came from a position whereby, like, and this is a part of who I was back then, you know what I mean? Not now, obviously, but who I was back then. So, you know, a couple of Ireland's in 16, minor goalie both years, 21 goalie for three. So, like, in my head, I was, like, unanimously the best goalie in Galway. Do you know what I mean? At that age, I thought in my head at that time, I said, and then I'm going to roll into the senior team, and it's just going to be a continuation of same. That's where my mindset was back then. And then when you get into the senior panel and things don't start to go the way you expect them to go, the first year, thinking, Jesus, I have to kind of fix my mindset a small bit here. And that took me a full year of kind of, I suppose, like I said, bedding in, like, to get come to terms with it, you know? And then when I got the jersey in 2008, I had some up and down performances that could, in fairness to Jurnow, he stuck with me and had a pretty good year. You know what I mean? So that was an amazing experience, to say, of a kid, well, I think it was anyway, at 20, to kind of start to nail down a jersey in his first real year, you could say.
And when did you lose it?
I lost it in 2009, and it was kind of a culmination of things, you could say. 2009 was a pretty shit year, excuse my language, but I broke my hand in, like, May, the day before my final year exams in college. So my hand was broke. Then I came back from a broken hand, and then my father passed away. And then when he passed away, that just triggered a whole series of shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, just bad mindset, bad mentality, bad person. Do you know what I mean? Bad player. I said that in the article with Arthur, that I didn't really come around from that until, realistically speaking, like May of 11. You know, and that's, I only got to 11. I only got to, excuse me, after that 2 years, let's say, from kind of May 2009, to May 11, I only kind of got back to where I was in the year previous, if you know what I mean, in 08, you get me?
Yeah, yeah.
And but then, like, from 11 onwards, I was still in a bad spot. So I still wasn't performing, I still wasn't the best player I could be. I wasn't putting myself in a position to be the best player I could be, you know what I mean, until, like, 12, and then that kind of kicked on a bit more better.
2 years of very intense grief, it sounds like, and I, you know, I think everybody deals with grief differently, and it never really goes away. I think that's kind of what makes human beings so strong, is that we always remember, and that's why humanity continues to exist. It seems to me, like, what happened 2 years later that allowed you somehow to be free from the biggest of the burden that you carried?
I wouldn't say I was free. I would say that I accepted it happened. And, you know, time does heal an awful lot, let's say. Well, I wasn't healed fully, don't get me wrong. I'd never be healed fully. And anyone who loses a person of such love, let's say, they'll never be healed rightly. They just kind of come to terms with it and keep moving on with their own lives, you could say. So come 11, and it was really, I had a conversation with Jamie Joyce. I've often mentioned him, let's say, and, you know, he's one of my best friends. But in terms of setting me on a path, right, I just had a very, very frank conversation with him. And what he had with me, should I say, he did most of the talk, and I did listening, you could say. And he kind of, it was more of a monkey see, monkey do attitude. Then I see him doing, I said, right, I'm just going to consciously try and make an effort to make the best effort I can to copy what he's doing, you know. And, like, still at the age of 41, that man is still, you know, he's in supreme shape and still plays for our club. So, like, he was a great example to follow. But I stopped doing what I was doing. So, and I'll be honest, sir, I was drinking alcohol during the year, let's say, when I shouldn't have been, you know. I was doing things that were completely uncharacteristic of me. I had bad discipline issues. I was just basically a prick for the 2 years. Let's be honest, right? And kind of when I spoke to Damien, he just kind of set me on a path. And then that was 2011. I had a good enough season in terms of my form, which kind of led me into 2012, which Anthony Cunningham took over. And I had an interview with every kind of senior player. Had an interview with Anthony and Tom Helbert and Matty Kinney. And they fairly grilled me on what had happened the 2 years before, which then kind of forewarned me that I can't do it again, you could say, which set me into a year of 2012. And that was when Anthony and Matty and Tom really backed me up and told me not to worry about Anthony, essentially. That set me on the road, then, you could say.
It's amazing how much influence a proper conversation can have. Like, you know, Damien having that conversation with you. Maddy Kenny seems to, from the piece, also had quite an important role. And I think this is all just about grief, isn't it? Like, you know, you were a prick for 2 years, but very understandably, given what you were carrying.
Yeah, well, understanding is one thing. It's just, I look back now, obviously I'm coming from a position of seniority now, looking back to a young fella, and, you know, it was my own, and you have to understand at a different time back then, my own sort of masculinity was getting in the way that I can't be asking for assistance here. Like, you know, if I ask for assistance, it's going to be looking like I'm asking for help, and if I need help, the management aren't going to trust me. If they don't trust me, I won't play. So all that triggered a series of thoughts in your head, right, you have to carry this yourself, carry the burden yourself. We had no sports psychology back then to a certain extent. No psychology. We had a sports psychologist, right, who could talk to you about sports, but no a grief counsellor. Do you know what I mean? A life coach. They weren't there back. They're there now. So if it all happened again, if God forbid, if a family member or a player passed away now, I think there's great structures in most counties to kind of facilitate that process. You know, back then there wasn't. And I suppose to come back, I made a whole host of mistakes in not saying anything, carrying the burden myself, being an asshole to people, thinking it was acceptable, you know. And only then Jaycee put me on, kind of gave me. And again, it was a frank conversation. And when you hear it coming from one of your best friends, it really cuts you deep. So I mean, in the right way. Not. He wasn't being, you know, facetious. Like, he was just giving me straight between the eyes what he thought had gone on the last couple of years, which was a major pillar for me to go forward. You know.
Do you remember what he said to you specifically?
I remember where I was exactly. I remember the time it was, and we're outside a community centre in Capshagel, and he called me down. And it was regular for him to call me down at that time because there was a vast age gap. So we weren't exactly best friends back then, but we've grown to be best friends, as he said. But he told me that the effect I was having on people in the club, the effect I was having on my mother, because his father passed away at a very young age when he was only like 4 or 5. So he saw the difficulty his mother had in raising a family throughout his life. And now, obviously, we were effectively raised, you know, so it was a different situation. But he told me that what she was going through was 10 times worse what I was going through, and just to cop myself on. And it's not all about you, essentially. And before you know it, your career is going to be gone. And you have the talents and you have the fruits to do it, but right now you're the only one holding you back is yourself. So either you put up or you shut up. You know, simple as that. And that was a real hammer blow, you could say, to get, but it was the best thing that happened. The best thing that happened, you know. He was captain of Galway at the time as well, just to coincide with that.
Mm. Like, do you remember how you felt when he gives that to you between both eyes at that exact moment?
I do, yeah. I felt like the first reaction was, he's wrong. There's no way, it's pure denial. You know what I mean? And the only way you move forward is through acceptance. And when I went home and digested it, you know, it only took me a day to digest it. He's right. He's actually right. Because when you go through all the series of events that went on in the 2 years prior or whatever, and you start to look really deeply and honestly, and who was at fault? And always it was pointed at myself. You know what I mean? And I'd say people in my own club team hated it. You know, because I was always given out, always under case for the wrong things. You know what I mean? I'd say my mother was happy to get me out of the house at 21. You know what I mean? When I left, which was quite young to move out. Granted, going to college to move out, but I moved out fully at 21. You know, I haven't been home since. But I said that was tough on her for the. And I say this in inverted commas, for the man of the house then to leave. You know what I mean? But I think it was necessity because I had to get away from all that, and they had to get away from me too. To be honest, you know what I mean? Because it was toxic, and it was me that was at fault. To be honest, which is hard to say now, but it's the truth, you know.
Hard to work through. You know, we obviously have sympathy now with the character you're describing because you're talking to us from this remove. But, like, you know, we've all seen people who are in the midst of that rage that you must have felt with the, alongside the grief. And we can understand how toxic, how easy it is for one person to make everything around them toxic. The recovery period from your own perspective, when you look back, how quickly do you become more mature, and how quickly do you start accepting that you need to be a better teammate and a better son and a better brother and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, I think full level of maturity and acceptance didn't really hit me until, I'm going to say honestly, the year 2019 or 2020. That sounds like and that was years apart. That's full, in my view, that's full maturity. I think from like 2011 up to 2018, excuse me, was gradual. You know what I mean? Whereby you stop, so me and my mother now have the best relationship possible, and I suppose everyone around the place thinks I'm a mammy's boy, and I've no problem saying that. I don't mind that. But we have a fantastic relationship. Me and my sister's a fantastic relationship. You know, all my cousins, everyone, great friends in the club, let's say, And so that had to grow over the course. Obviously, it started with family first. Like they're the most important people to mature with and understand you were wrong and fix that. And then it became outside life, let's say. And when you go out, let's say, on a social event, to hold yourself rightly. And then, you know, in work, hold yourself in a high position that warrants your position at work. Do you know what I mean? And so on and so forth. So I'm going to say it took me 8 years, you know, with talking to various people as well. I used various people to help me in the line of psychologists and people who had gone through similar experiences. Like, so without those conversations, you know what I mean? And I suppose that time, I wouldn't, you know, I'd still be in a similar position where I was years ago. So I'm going to say right now I've accepted it. You know what I mean? And it's just, I have kind of rectified what I was back then.
What does that maturity look like in 2018, 2019? Like, how have you changed?
I can be quite excitable at times. That's the PG version of saying it. Whereas that would translate to, I've a bit of a temper. Okay, that's genetic. That's not. I'm going to pass that on to my father, his side, right? Whereas right now, take example as in a club game, right? If someone passed a comment to me a few years back, I would automatically see red, and straight away I'd want to get them back. Do you know what I mean? And then I'd do my team harm, and then you go, damn it, I should have done that. Whereas nowadays, I say anyone can say anything to me, it doesn't matter, because I just know it's about the team. My performance is 1/15 of the team, and like, I'm not bigger than the team, so I don't have to. I set my personal, you know, agenda aside. I want to win, and if I win, we all win. If we all win, I win. So it's kind of maturity not to be listening to BS on the pitch or off the pitch, believing it and trying to go after them. Do you know what I mean? Or even if you have a conversation with a family member and they might say something about your performance that you didn't like, or, you know, and you just accept it. Whereas in years ago, if this isn't my performance, I'd nearly hold a grudge against them for a week, you know. Do you know what I mean? Or if they commented positively on a rival, you know, a rival goalkeeper, I'd be saying, they're against me now. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't talk to them for a couple of days. Do you know what I mean? That was the mindset. It was terribly hard to articulate and to understand where was I back then. Whereas now it's like, you know, you just deal with things better. You deal with situations better, whether it's on the pitch, off the pitch. You deal with people way better. You know, and you just grow as a person. That's it. And like, especially then, what really happened then was when you have children. So when my firstborn came along, Sophie, that was a real, you know, you're very fallible. Like, so you're not just representing yourself now. You have to take care of this person, you know? So it's on you. So put all your own shit aside and look after this little one. That's really what was the trigger of all the maturity, if you like.
The importance of hurling in all of this is actually primary to everything. It's like, and that really comes across very well in Arthur's piece, which I can't recommend enough that people go and read. But the fact that Damien Joyce was the captain of the Galway Hurlers, and that your life's ambition was to be the number one in Galway, and that was now at risk all of a sudden because of your behaviour, it sounds like that was also very important in kind of just waking you up a little bit.
It was, yeah. Like, and throughout all that, even the hurlers, the guys, whether they're my own age or years above me, they were excellent to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I still hold them all very close to me in the sense that what they too put up with shit. You know what I mean? And they brought me along as the lads. You know what I mean? And Colin was huge in that. You know, like, I don't think you know, people ask me like, how did you get on with Colin so well? Or how are you not? Why didn't you dislike him because you were rivals? And first and foremost, he's a great dude. He's a great person. He's a friend of mine. So put hurling aside that for a second. And yes, hurling introduced us. Don't get me wrong. But like, we're kind of really two compassionate people, let's say. You know, he's hilarious, like, so he's great to be around. You know what I mean? He's kind of infectious. So like, first and foremost, he's a friend. And like, when you're a friend with someone, you only want the best of them, and vice versa. That's why our relationship was so good. You know what I mean? And it was important for him, like, for me to have him. You know what I mean? And I'd be honest about it, when he retired in 19, like, it just, even though he was a coach, it still wasn't the same. You know what I mean? Which, you know, it's not the same. And I was only talking to a player recently, and a senior player, he was talking about a couple of retirements, and he was saying it's not the same. The dressing room is insane when you lose. Yes, you're in a high intense environment, which you're looking for success. But when you lose a couple of people who you classed as really good friends, you know, it's difficult to overcome. And then your why, as I put in one of our comments, kind of subsides a bit. You know what I mean? So like, that's why when Colin retired, yes, he was a coach. I just, you know, it began. You know, it's not the same anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. You
know, I might be explaining that well, but yeah.
You want to enjoy the whole. One of the reasons that you stay committed to it is because you actually enjoy. You get off a little bit on the suffering and the sacrifice and the pain. Like, that's kind of, and you enjoy that part. But you also have to enjoy the downtime, because otherwise it just becomes a chore. And there was one other really strong piece that, like, you're, this is a hobby, why don't you just give it up, stop banging on about the sacrifices, that kind of, there was that whole, oh, these poor inter-county players, that there was a strain, particularly in the mid-teens there, where it was like people were criticising the commitment of the inter-county players as one of the things that was driving the arms race, and the constant refrain was, why don't you just walk away, you should give it up, it's only a hobby.
Yeah, yeah, and like, you know, I think I had a debate with a person a few years ago, not a debate, it was a conversation with me, about the, you know, the GPA grants that are being offered to players, you know, and she was saying that essentially that it was ridiculous, and there was people who needed that money far more. And, you know, you can contest the GPA grants all you want, right? My belief is that the GA players should be semi-professional, and they should be adequately expensed, you know what I mean? Or I'm not going to say paid, but expensed for what they bring to the game. So that's my belief, right? But in terms of the most simplistic approach, and it normally happens on Twitter, right, that you'll get on people who would engage you and say, just give up the game, sure, if that's difficult, why? And they're from people who, the vast majority, wouldn't have played a game at that level at all, I say. So the understanding, they're not coming from a position of understanding. So I'm not going to comment on something unless I've either went through it or I understand it, because then I'm misinformed. So you'll never see me commenting on cricket. Just me, I have no idea what's going on. So, like, but I'm in a great position to comment on inter-county GAA, because I've done it for 14 years. And so, yes, it's a game, and we love to play, and it's fantastic for winning and for, you know, big crowds, etc. But you must understand that probably two-thirds of GAA players will never experience will never experience a full Croke Park, will never experience an Ireland win, they'll never experience a provincial win, you know, they'll never experience a homecoming, all these things. So you ask yourself, why are GAA players playing the game? And it's much deeper than success or participation. It's your community, like, do you know what I mean? So my neighbour up the road, 93 years of age, and he gets so wound up, let's say, to see us winning club games that it's like he's playing with us, you know what I mean? And it was the same going back through my career, say, if I didn't play with Galway, I wouldn't be letting down, I'd be letting down myself, but I'd be letting down so many people in Cashtagel, you know, who actually take great pride on saying, we've got a county player. From a club historically that wouldn't have no senior titles, wouldn't have been senior for 95% of their time. So it would be very difficult for me to get in a position of prominence in a Galway team and then to give it up, when I know I'm representing something much deeper than myself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think people fail to understand that, which I can side with, because they haven't gone through it.
So that, but for me, James, that's the external part. The internal part is that the other part of this is that hurling is in you. That, like, it's the public manifestation and the community is very important, but actually it is your identity.
Absolutely. And someone said to me, Justin Campbell, before, when he gave us the talk, he said that, you know, when you walk into any public place, like, say, you're always wearing a jersey, you know, that's fine, that's okay, but it's bred into me, it's genetic, it's hereditary, it's put into me as a child. So it's like, it's, I wouldn't call it a drug, I just call it, it was a calling, you know what I mean? There was never going to be a situation where I wasn't going to be a hurler, and that was put into me through family. All my uncles played, my mother was a good player, so do you know what I mean? Imagine if I left the Galway pedal, what my mother would do to me, you know what I mean? it's bred into me, it's in my blood, you know what I mean? And it's easy, and I can give you all the lovely snippets here and all the lovely, you know, sound notes of what it means, but it's just in your soul as a person, you know what I mean? Every player that's playing, it's bred into them, and they're not going to deny it, you know what I mean? And it's for those who understand it and then really make it grow as ones that are good, you know?
And that's why, for me, reading the piece, it felt like it was such an important part of your recovery, because we haven't spoken about this. You blamed yourself for your dad's death.
Yeah, I did. And I know, like, the easy thing is people turn around and they say, oh, wasn't your fault? Like, you weren't flipping there. You know what I mean? Like, I was there, and I can remember the exact position in the field I was when I said, right, we're going to the doctor. And he said, no, I'm fine. And me being naive and young, believed him, saying, that's fine. But when I look back now on the symptoms he was showing, it was obvious the clock was ticking, and it was ticking down the way. You know what I mean? And I said, geez, if I just caught him, now he was strong, so me catching him was never going to be an issue. But do you know what I mean? If I just coaxed him a bit better or put a bit more effort, he'd be still alive. So that kind of way. And that's what I carried for a long time. And my mother and uncle say, wasn't your fault? That's fine. You can say that to me, right? But in reality, in my head, it was. You know what I mean? And it's only again, as you go through the years, last year, the year before, that I accepted it wasn't. There was very little I could have done, you know, because he was in a much more senior position than me, a much more mature position. So he should have flipped and done the right thing and go to the hospital. You know what I mean?
So, yeah.
I accepted that. You know, I accepted that. And that was, you know,
eventually.
That was important. That was important to do, you know.
I'm sure, because otherwise you'd never feel at peace. But it seems, James, intertwining of your identity as a hurler and who you come from and the genetic makeup and that conversation you just had, I think it's clear as well, though, that you've learned lessons from hurling that you're applying to life of needing help from outside and asking for help. And you talked about your own masculinity getting in the way. You stepping outside of that and going, actually, I do need help.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And even I use my professional life, to say, in contracts manager with Kerry, to say, and then my call it social life in terms of hurling, they're so intertwined in that the attributes you need and the mentality you need are very, very similar in terms of needing, like, people. It's all people. You need people and people need you. And it's the relations and how you build those relations and not tarnish them or break them, do you know what I mean? And in order to build relations, you have to have a good health mentality and you have to have open eyes, you know what I mean? And it's not all about you, etc. So those two are very intertwined. Hurling has taught me an awful, awful lot of how to be a professional in terms of my professional career. And I honestly don't think if I didn't have the hurling or sport in general, I wouldn't be where I am professionally at the moment. I'd say that would be 10 years later. So it's kind of expedited my career indirectly, if you know what I mean.
How do you think you'll handle the progression of life when club hurling isn't a thing anymore or sport isn't a part of your life anymore?
Yeah, I think I'll always have an involvement in sport and something like that. I personally need to be always looking forward. I can't be looking back. That's not good for me. I need to be looking forward to next game, next training session. And at present, it's about me preparing myself to play, you know? Whereas I think as the years go on, it'll be about me preparing myself to coach or to manage or to, you know, to fundraise or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Where I'll always have a focus that'll be centred around sport. And I would pretty much bet it's going to be in hurling, obviously. I don't know this word, but it's going to be a tricky one for me, but I'm going to stay involved in sport some way. So I'm hoping for it to be an easy transition, but we'll wait and see.
The piece is absolutely sensational. It's highly recommended. Just one of the other things that came out from the piece, well, one of the things that I didn't really know from the piece was Arthur spoke to Christy O'Connor about a certain drill he had done with Colm Callan, which was initially reported by Dennis Walsh in the Sunday Times. In Christy's own words, he said he absolutely reddened him. We all know that goalkeepers are absolutely mad, James, but I presume you've been put under the pump quite a bit with similar drills.
Or reddened, that's a nice way of putting it, you know, saying reddened. When you first tug out and it's cold, you want to get your hands going, you know what I mean? You don't want the ball to come at you and you have to catch it every time. And he used to do it every day, hit the ball so hard and the pain in your hand. But as the session go on, and he had the most unorthodox drills that you'd ever do, but they were so applicable. Like, we had a drill one time whereby he was coming down with polythene, a roll of polythene, you know, and fairy liquid, and Colm and I look at each other and we're going, where is he going with polythene and fairy liquid? he goes, right, lad, he said, the weekend is promise wet, so he said, what I'm trying to replicate now is skinny ground, right? Fine. So he put down the polythene in front of us, okay, and he squirted fairy liquid all across it, and then he started hitting the ball off the polythene sheet. And could we hell save it, because it was bouncing, you know, skidding this way, skidding that way. But I just thought the ingenuity of it, I never would have thought of it anyway. Do you know what I mean? But and it's funny, they're great experiences just to picture him. I can still picture him coming down with a roll of polythene, wondering what in the name of God has he got next. Do you know what I mean? But he kept it fresh. He'd do drills all the time. That's why it was so enjoyable.
He's a genius at some level. There's a strain of madness, and just the quality of work, the body of work that he's put together over as a rider over the last two decades now is absolutely sensational stuff. We have to let you go. We haven't even talked to Henry. We'll get you back on soon enough to talk about that. But James, I think honestly, Ireland has for such a long time hidden in secrets and pain, and we don't talk about these things, and for you to talk openly the way you did with Arthur and again today is a testimony to you and to your family and the people that you come from. So thanks a million for sharing that with us.
Thanks yourself for having me on.
James, great stuff. Thanks. James Keller, with that story. And if you want to read more, there's a long piece that you should Get Your Hands On by Arthur and Arthur James O'D. You can get it on otbsports.com. It is bang on 9 o'clock this morning. OTB AM live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold is Joe meeting Gerlach Nan at 1 o'clock. At three, it is Leaders Questions. That's the Stuart Lancaster Leadership Series. At 4 o'clock, it's our retro panel, Structure versus Spontaneity. And OTB Gold at six is Wexford 56 with Ned Wheeler and Art Foley. Up next this morning on OTB AM, we're going to hear from John Duggan. We're talking football, Phil Egan.
OTB AM.
5 minutes past nine. John Duggan is here with us. John.
Jarrah and Owen, how are you doing?
Interesting morning, John.
Yeah, I think I need to lie down after watching that stadium debate, to be honest, lads.
You're a sports fan. Let's get more stadiums. Let's have a stadium in every small town in the country. That's what we need.
Well, I don't really understand the Tottenham Hotspur argument around this. Tottenham Hotspur make £800,000 when things are normal per match. The football club was bought for £20 million in 20 years ago. It's now worth £2 billion. In a global game, which has a lot of potential owners with deep pockets, it's based in London. It's a state-of-the-art, magnificent stadium. So Tottenham, I can understand why they would do that for the next 20 to 30 years.
Good point, right? And just to add to that, they have another anchor tenant in the NFL who have agreed a deal with them that is a long-term deal that they will bring NFL games to the stadium. So there's going to be a minimum of two and sometimes three and potentially more than that down the line. Like,
you can't sell Signature Park. This is not happening. I don't understand this argument. I think it's a bit of kite flying. We're not going to have a new stadium in this country. But it does open up the debate about our infrastructure in the country, which is definitely a very healthy debate. If the Aviva Stadium, which is a new stadium, and Croke Park are good enough to be part of an England bid for 2030 World Cup, great. We're going to be down the pecking order anyway in terms of the matches we can hold. 4 to 5 games, maybe a last 16 match, a quarter final, maybe at the very most. Great if we can do it. But that should be based on the Aviva Stadium and Croke Park and any upgrades we need to perform to those stadiums. That is it. Like Luxembourg, we played them recently. It was a 9,000, state-of-the-art new 9,000-seater stadium. That's what the politicians in the country need to be looking at. And we need to be looking at getting out of silos when it comes to the way we run our sport in this country. Imagine you had a stadium in Connacht. You're talking about building stadiums. Why wouldn't you build a stadium for 30,000 people in Connacht to host Connacht Rugby, Galway GAA, and
or 15,000
or Galway United?
I'd go 15,000 and make it amazing week in. I'd make it 12,000 and make it amazing atmosphere week in, week out. I'd even go 8,000, unbelievable comfort, a family area, you know, like you can have your corporate area if you want, but like, to, you know, but like the smaller boutique the better, and the sound for gigs, if they were to have gigs there, would be sensational. Like,
well, yeah, why don't you have Cork City playing in Páirc Uí Chaoimh every week and building a momentum of a fan base there?
It's too big. I think I would argue that you could put 10,000 in Páirc Uí Chaoimh and it's going to look a bit shit because the stadium's too big.
But over time, if it gets to 15,000, 20,000, I mean, League of Ireland grounds were, you know, 30, 40 years ago, where there was the big sport in this country. And I just think that there's so many white elephants and there's too many stadiums. There's too many stadiums which are not fit for purpose and they're all based in different sports. And I just see Páirc Uí Chaoimh with £30 million of taxpayers' money put into it. How many times is it used a year? And I maybe talking about having another new stadium? Come on.
It doesn't make any sense. The other thing is that aren't Spain and Portugal going to win this?
Is it
a South American bid?
The reason you might think that England wouldn't win it because of the disgraceful scenes that we saw at Wembley for the European Championship final and that they can't control their fans and they don't have a security infrastructure around it. But Seferin seems to be quite positive about England for 2030. So I think the big opponent would be Argentina and Uruguay because it would be 100 years since the hosting of the first World Cup down in South America. So I think they're the big rival. But England, I think, are in good standing with UEFA, maybe for the first time in a while. And I think that's why this is still, I suppose, a live issue for the Republic of Ireland and Ireland as a nation.
I guess it costs money to put a bid in. It makes a lot of sense if you're Seferin or Infantino to encourage all the bids possible. It's like, yeah, your bid is definitely a good idea because it's going to cost a certain amount of money.
There is a legacy. There is a legacy in terms of people seeing Ireland for the first ever time. People coming from all over the world to go to games here. So I do see the positivity around that, but not at the exorbitant cost that could be put out there for any kind of new infrastructure. We have, I think the Aviva Stadium is a good modern stadium. It has about 50,000 capacity. It's hosted a Europa League final. It could host another European final in the next couple of years. Nothing wrong with that.
And we don't actually need to try and host an Olympic Games. Like, oh, you can say you're never going to be at the party. Grant. That's grand. It looks like a shit party. It's really expensive. There's no point to it. You're taking money from our services that we need and you're giving it to somebody else. I'm down with not being a member of that party. I'm still down with missing out. Those cool kids aren't so fucking cool.
They're still paying for Montreal 1976.
Pardon me.
They're still paying for it. I was in Brazil and you have all these stadiums now just empty. I could understand why they did it in Russia. I could understand why they built stadiums like in Kaliningrad in this exclave, which is really, really poor. I could understand why Putin did all this because he wanted to, I suppose, show Russia in a different light, that because it was being portrayed so negatively as a country to the Western world and to all of the world. And they put on an amazing show. I could understand some of the reasons. But like in Moscow, they had the Luzhniki, which they just refurbished. Luzhniki's been there back to the 1980 Olympic Games, and the Spartak Stadium was a compact, tight stadium, 20,000-30,000, hosted a load of games. You've got to build on your existing infrastructure, but not to the extent where it turns out like Porky Creek, where you have just a handful of games a year.
If the plan is to build a 12,000-15,000 seater stadium somewhere in the Dublin area that's going to be used for multiple sports, I'm down with that. That's a completely different prospect. And if the trade off was that the other stadiums had to be made available when on suitable occasions, I'd be down with that too.
Yeah.
Trouble is, the pitch of the Aviva is big enough to host GAA, so that's never going to happen. That was baked in from the get go because that suited the politics of the day.
Can we rewind here a little bit and can we predict an alternative reality where the Bertie Bowl actually did get built? Twofold. First of all, Abbottstown doesn't exist, the potential facility there. And second of all, what would our relationship with the Bertie Bowl be now? What would the practicality of it be? What would have actually happened? Like,
you're pretty grim going out there all the time.
Do you think Ireland would be playing there?
Trains out to wherever it would
Lansdowne
be.
Road wouldn't have got done up, maybe?
I don't think Lansdowne Road would have got done up if that was it. I think they would have sold it for housing. You'd have very expensive houses there, but maybe they would have got the timing wrong in those.
Which nobody can afford.
Or maybe they would have got the timing right in those and they would have sold those for like a billion and then the property crash happens and they're like, woohoo, that all worked out pretty well. I don't know. The timing would have been interesting. The Bertie Bowl was around 2002, so you would have got that done at the peak of the boom, so it would have been very expensive, but you would have also sold the housing stock. Croke Park would never have been sold. They would have kept that. So you'd have two 80,000-seater stadiums that are never full.
Was it supposed to be 80, the Bertie Bowl?
I think so. Maybe. I don't know. I don't want to... In my head, it's 80.
You don't want to do the Bertie Bowl any injustice?
I don't want to slander the Bertie Bowl. It's like, it could sue me. 12 minutes past 9 here this morning on OTB AM. We're live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move. John, you've got to get you on the Movember train next year. I don't know how you managed to miss it this year. I think you might have been away when we were doing it the first day.
Yeah.
And I didn't goad you into it. But I'm putting you on notice.
No problem, yeah.
2022, I had to check the year there.
Yeah, no problem now. It'll probably take me until next November to grow the moustache.
Get so, going. I'm the same.
Because I have the baby skin. So look, we'll give that a go, definitely. I will never look as good as Joseph Conroy, one of our OTB team here, because he looks amazing. Definitely.
The moustache is nice too.
Hey.
I just know that the Rugby World Cup, all those things came out yesterday. Your 2027 Australia, 2031 they're looking to have the United States. We don't have the infrastructure in this country with the joined up thinking to be able to host these big things. And that was another thing that kind of struck me yesterday,
Like, nobody likes the aftermath of their own party. Can't we just go and enjoy other people's hospitality?
England, Scotland, Wales. Happy days.
Let's try and qualify for soccer world tournaments and also let's try and win the Rugby World Cup. Why don't we do that? Why don't we do the opposite thing? Let's go there and do things that are great.
Everybody likes to go on tour. What's going on, John?
Last night, there was one thing interesting about Pochettino. Can Pochettino manage big personalities? Because that'll be the question if he does go to United with Ronaldo and with Pogba, if Pogba's still there. Because it seemed to me, watching that game last night, that PSG did not work in anywhere near as hard enough as Tottenham used to work. And I don't know if he's happy there. And I don't know if he's getting the best tune out of these three personalities, these three superstars, Mbappe, Neymar and Messi. Because Messi and Neymar were just walking around for the whole game. And in modern football, you have to press and you have to be 11 players as a unit, as we saw with Manchester City last night, as we've seen with Liverpool over the last few years. And I don't think PSG are going to be winning the Champions League, and that's one of the reasons. Like, Pochettino managed the Champions League final situation very badly, in that Harry Kane was not fit, but he still felt he had to play him. And I'm just wondering if he does go into United, and he seems to be the preferred choice, not on an interim basis, because that can't happen, I don't think. But if he is the choice next summer, how he will manage these personalities. Is he more of a manager for younger players, for underdogs, than what we've we could potentially see at Man United? The list of names, like for Valverde, seems to be the popular one at the moment. But I think for United, it's just a case of getting to next May.
I think there was a great injection of good common sense into the conversation on yesterday's show when we were talking with Philippe Auclair. He basically made it sound like the arrogance of Manchester United, that they're going to just be able to take one of the super club's other managers mid-season. It was kind of a that old cologne. Well, why wouldn't he? And all the English papers like, well, why do they need an interim? Just use your money to get what you want. It's like, Paris Saint-Germain also have money. Mm. There are other sources of money in the world that maybe have even more money. Mm. Imagine that. So that was interesting.
You've got to be looking at somebody out of work. Valverde is out of work.
Exactly.
Conte was out of work, and they could have had Conte.
It was stupid. That Spurs game is like...
You can already see with Spurs' second half performance against Leeds. Conte probably, I don't know, banished them to hell for 10 minutes, brought them back from hell, and said, okay, you guys got to play a certain way now. And they were amazing the second half. So
I think Pochettino wants to win the league. He referenced the league title and how they were running away with it. And so Pochettino is going to arrive having won a league, having reached the quarterfinals at least and seen what happens. I'm not writing them off just yet. I think in a one-off over two legs, they might try a bit more of a leg. I think that, like, you're right, they didn't try a leg last night. But I think that over the course of 180 minutes where it's do or die, then I think Messi is going to put on as much of an effort as he possibly can. And I think it's the same with the other two. So I'm not writing them off just yet. And I think that actually it is the right thing for Pochettino not to come right now and to say, actually, if you want me, these are my conditions. I'm not going to accept Carrick and his crew as my coaching ticket, or I am going to accept them, but I'm going to accept them because I'm going to be, these are the players on my list. And also, you've protected your Cristiano Ronaldo legacy marketing stuff. Off he goes.
Can you really say to Ronaldo or to the club that no, Ronaldo, you know, is not
part of my plans? I think they're so screwed at the moment. Like, there's a brilliant column today in The Examiner about how they've become a comedy act.
Tommy's, is it?
Tommy Martin's comedy piece. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant today. And he's right. He's right. There is like a high farce element to the whole thing. And so if Pochettino comes in and says, Ronaldo's not going to play and he's going to be difficult, so we can have that long extraction over the course of a year and you don't get value for money, and then he perhaps, or we just cash in now and say, you've done your bit for us, that was excellent, he's not going to another English team, there's no way Man City are going to sign him after that, and there's no way he's going to go there. So that function has been formed. He wins his title, he gets rid of Pogba and Ronaldo, and then suddenly he has the underdog thing going again, and all of a sudden, like, it's,
yeah, you could be great with Sancho, you can imagine
Rashford, Greenwood,
yeah, getting the best out of all these players, but ooh, it's a hard battle to be won with Ronaldo, I think, at the moment.
Alright,
and Jorge Mendes, more importantly.
Good stuff, John. The show on Saturday, what,
yeah,
you got coming?
We got a Renault panel about hybrid sports, so, like, you know, players that have played more than one sport. So Jason Sherlock's going to be on talking about soccer and obviously GAA. Mickey Quinn's going to be on talking about AFL and GAA. And then Mick Galway, an All-Ireland winner with Kerry, and then his great rugby career with Ireland. And then football-wise, we've got, we're going to be looking back on the women's game, obviously, this evening. And then previewing the FAI Cup final, Mark Roster, who won the Cup with Bows. And also played for Pats, is going to be in with the lads, Dan and Johnny, to look ahead to that, and obviously all the latest in the Premier League. So 1-5 on News Talk here on Off the Ball.
All right, we're going to be talking about Vera Powell with Phil in just a couple of minutes' time. It's 18 minutes past 9 this morning. Very good and interesting chat with Skell. Just shows what goes on off the field, affects on-field performance, says P-Well on YouTube. Very few can put it to one side and perform on-field in any sport, particularly in amateur sport, where everybody does have to go about their work as well. So if you missed that chat with James Skell, it is up on our podcast feed. Just subscribe to GA wherever you get your pods, but the best place is the OTB Sports app these days. Right, Brian O'Driscoll joined us this week to reflect on Ireland's autumn series. You can get the podcast first exclusively on the OTB Sports app for 24 hours before everywhere else. Download it on Apple or Android, just search for OTB Sports. Here he is talking about the undroppable Hugo Keenan. OTB AM. The only problem would be, like, where Sexton, irreplaceable. No injury at 10 ever allowed. Murray, no injury at 9 ever allowed. Now it's like, okay, we might be able to muddle through. But if Keenan goes down, it's like, nobody's that good. We don't have any backup to him at the moment, do we? Who you can go, yeah, I trust you the way I now trust Hugo Keenan, who's been part of our lives forever.
Yeah, probably not at the moment, but that comes with, he played 14 consecutive tests or something. Yeah, it's you all of a sudden you become very reliant on someone who, you know, people would have been asking questions as to what he was doing there. Surely he didn't belong in international rugby yet. He's played his way in a very short period of time, got into the Leinster team, into the Irish team, and now becomes
undroppable. You know,
yeah, undroppable. There's other guys like Shane Daly that, if he gets his opportunity, I think can be a very, very good international player as well. Just hasn't had that chance yet to, you know, and that'll come through some form of injury, through Hugo in the next few years, or he's playing his, you know, playing the house down for Munster. If he does get to play at on the winger 15, Mike Haley, I don't see him coming. I think there's more, there's a higher ceiling in Daly than there is in Haley. Yeah, it is. It's exciting that we're talking about so many different players.
Yeah, more of that goodness on. You'll hear the whole thing on the radio on Friday, but the only place to hear the full thing is on the OTB Sports app at the moment. Now, Phil is with us. Phil, good morning to you.
Morning, lads. How are you doing?
I'm well. I'm fully present. I've been here for every second of the show, unlike Owen, who, although he's been here, in body, his spirit is elsewhere. Where are you, Owen?
Well, like, I mean, at about 8:35 this morning, I saw everybody tweeting about Garth Brooks, and I was like, you know what? That would be a good Christmas present. The problem was, it was 35 minutes past 8, 35 minutes after tickets got on sale. So I've just been a good citizen and I've hopped in queue on Ticketmaster. So currently, for Saturday tickets, there are 105,776 people between me and getting my hands on those sweet, sweet tickets. But Aiken Promotions, over the course of the last 20 minutes, have announced a third date for Garth Brooks. Breaking news, everybody, this morning. These tickets aren't for me, just to reiterate. And I clicked into the second date. I clicked into the third date. And there are 105,381 people before me. How is that possible? How is there a new date and there are still 105,000 between me and getting over the finish line? How does this work? I don't know. Something's fishy here. I think, like, the same people who are going to be in the stadium the Saturday night are going to be there the Sunday night. People who've already got tickets for the other night are stopping me getting a very handy Christmas present and will sort out a good portion of my family.
Okay. You asked a very interesting question, Phil, that we're now going to speculate on before we talk about the women's game tonight.
Yeah, I wondered, because Owen obviously says the tickets for his parents, but for all we know, Owen,
for a friend,
he's got the cowboy hat on. But who out of off the ball would be the most likely Garth Brooks fan? And I kind of was leaning towards Shane Hannon, because I thought, you know, Monaghan, yeah, good tradition of country music.
The seat of country and Western power in Ireland.
A few Czech shirts. I thought I could see Shane Hannon at
line dancing
Park.
And the Budweiser belt buckle.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, and look in the part. With his Wranglers on, no bother.
And that's a very good end. I'm going straight in at number one, the Beast from Ballyhonus, Nate Dogg Murphy. That's what I'm saying.
Why Nathan? He's like, he popped up at a Happy Mondays gig. He's a big Radiohead fan.
Yeah, but he used to DJ in Galway.
Okay, well, that's
from the West.
Do you know who it actually really is, lads? It is Tommy Rooney. Tommy Rooney is the biggest Garth Brooks stan in our midst. Yeah. He is there with his cowboy hat on at the morning, going like, I got tickets high. It's like you're number one. I don't want to use the phrase, but like a bit of a muck savage. I mean, like that is I'm from Kerry. I can say it. I mean, like he's got that flowing through his veins. He's moved down to Clare. He's moved down to the West. You talk about country music. I mean, he's moved to the West. I would be shocked if he is not in the top 100,000 people queuing for tickets right now. He's screwing my parents over from getting a good Christmas present because he's buying double tickets, Tommy Rooney. But I would say
he's buying tickets for the whole Meath Hill first team. That was their reward this year for not getting relegated.
Yeah, say that again.
They still have the t-shirts from the first time.
Oh, well, I mean, you can just roll them out once again.
Collector's items. I'm sure they've actually gone up in value.
I would say, like, anybody who's there, like, I mean, has anybody actually been to Nashville? I mean, like, I've been there. I've been to the home of country. Let me in, Ticketmaster, please, for the love of God.
Tommy.
Jojo, let me in. Did he just call me a muck savage?
He did.
I couldn't even name two bloody Garth Brooks songs.
He did call you a muck savage.
Could he not name two Garth Brooks songs, no?
I know the one, the Friends in, what is it again?
Oh, look at this.
Come on.
Friends in Low Places.
There you go.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
I'll be honest, lads, I can imagine Garth Brooks being great crack, and it'd be a cultural event for this country to, course, for people, yes, to go to it. And do you know, it'll be, as you said, Owen, a good Christmas present. But no, it wouldn't be for me. Now, like,
it'll be a little bit like a Wales match, I suspect. I just think, yeah, without the 6-year-olds, it's going to be a little bit like a Wales match.
Do you know, yeah, I think yeah, people will bring family to it. I think this will be one of those seminal moments in Irish history. They will not want their kids to miss out on it, like.
No.
Not that I will be going to it or purchasing tickets. I'm not in the queue, so I don't think I can be accused of being a Garth Brooks fan. I do think it'll be a bit of crack.
You're going, aren't you?
No, well, no. You're not in the queue. Not at the minute. Had I considered jumping into the queue... No, because I'm terrible at buying tickets for events. I'm actually brutal at it. I never get it done. Jared, would you not go to it? No.
No.
I feel like this is something that you'd love.
No. Not my thing. No.
It's only around the corner.
It is only around the corner, yeah.
Egan's a sleeper. Egan's a sleeper. He definitely,
he's a bit of a sleeper. Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah. Phil Egan,
yeah,
definitely.
You married into the West.
Do you know what? When I am out west, there is very much a country vibe going on with some of the music in the kitchen, but... No, I'm not going to queue, but there is going to be more concerts. Oh, you'll be all right.
I hope so.
What are we at, 3 now?
I'm saving myself for Bruce Springsteen to come back to Croke Park next year, so I'm hoping that's going to happen. Lads, I'm going to let you get back to the football.
Thanks. Just to clear your good name, not a muck savage, Tommy Rooney, this morning. 9:25, let's talk about the Republic of Ireland tonight against Slovakia. We need to make sure that our pants fit.
Yeah. That was the message. So if you put your pants on that are too big a size, they will go down to your ankles.
Did you mean pants trousers?
Yeah.
We misinterpreted that.
No, I knew she meant pants trousers.
Oh, I thought you meant jocks.
No.
Yeah.
Right.
So okay. Basically, don't get too carried away because obviously, you know, we're still reveling in the win over Finland, which was the big game. But Slovakia come to town and they're quite hard to break down. Sweden and Finland have both beaten them, but only by the odd goal. So we're not really in a position yet to just think we're going to turn up and win this game. But it will be interesting to see. It'll probably be a fairly similar lineup, but somebody like Katie McCabe or Denise O'Sullivan are real creative players, are going to get the ball in more advanced positions because we're going to be on the front foot. Slovakia are going to come and just try and defend and basically make sure they don't lose the game and see what they can get if they can get anything on the counter-attack. So it could be a night to be patient. And that Sweden scored quite early against Slovakia and that was it. They got a 1-0 win. They couldn't get the second goal.
Slovakia aren't rubbish. We were kind of dismissing them here as a team who were just going to waltz in and hammer, and we're not really at that stage of our evolution
definitely not. And I feel the same even about the Georgia game on Tuesday, where it's a game you'd expect to win, but it's unlikely that it's a game that Ireland are going to go and win 4-5-0. We're just not at that level just yet, but obviously we're on an upward curve, and it could be a very pivotal night in the group as well, because if we get the win, it's on after Sweden play Finland. That game kicks off at 5:30. Ours is at 7:00. Obviously more than 6,000 tickets sold. It's going to be good atmosphere, and you know, there's something nice building, especially at Tallaght Stadium. And the good news is Katie McCabe has been past fit to play. But yeah, we've seen this in the past. We did the hard work of beating Ukraine in the last campaign, and then when we went out there, a game that all we had to do was draw to get a playoff, we came unstuck and lost 1-0 with the most bizarre on goal, and we missed a penalty. So there is always reason to be sceptical of a sting in the tail, but I still expect Ireland to get the win and then build on it and then hopefully beat Georgia, and the table will look a lot better come Tuesday night.
Yeah, the consistency is the most important thing to see from the team at the moment, and we have been horribly inconsistent up until the last 3 or 4 games where there's been clear signs of progress, but it's such a small sample size that we need to make sure we don't regress.
Yeah, I think what we've noticed in the last few games, obviously playing against quality opposition, the win against Australia was massive in the sense that it ended the run of defeat. So that conversation was parked. It wasn't a case of going into the Sweden game, the toughest game you can get in Europe, the top-ranked team in Europe, number 2 in the world, where people were still asking Vera Pauw about a losing streak. That was put to bed. So then it was just about, what can you do against Sweden? It was all about testing ourselves against the best. And apart from one little slip, we cope quite well. You can definitely see the shape of the team is pretty good. That's an easier side of things to work on, making yourself hard to beat. It's now evolving to become a team that when you have the ball in possession and you're on the front foot, that you're cohesive in attack. So that's the next phase of development, and hopefully we'll get a glimpse of it tonight, that Ireland are going to have plenty of possession, that we're incisive and we're clinical, and just start on the front foot and play with intensity. And somebody like Heather Payne is crucial to that intensity, because she just covers every blade of grass and on the pitch. I think back to that Australia game when she's still on the pitch and she's stretching her calves out because she's cramping up, and then a minute later she's sprinting for the ball. So that's what you want from your team, and said hopefully the big crowd that goes tonight is going to have something to cheer about.
Yeah, Katie McCabe has talked as well about the evolution of the fitness of the team, and it's something that Karen Duggan has talked about as well, is that like previously we might have been good for an hour, but now the team is actually good for 93, 94 minutes, and players are making those lung busting runs, still attacking at the very end of the game. So we've made a quantum leap, but this is where it starts to get very high risk and high reward. We could qualify for the World Cup, a much more difficult tournament to qualify for than the Euros, which we didn't qualify for, and we're in a really good strong position to do it. But these are the games you've got to take care of business. To be honest, Phil, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if we win this 1-0 and it's a header from a corner. Like, it doesn't feel yet like we have fully reached our expression of what the creative side of the game is.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, set pieces have always been key, and I mentioned the Australia game. I was actually sitting right behind the corner flag where Katie McCabe whipped in the corner for Louise Quinn's winning header, and it was such a good ball. It was just been, it was begging for someone to get their head on it, and Louise Quinn, we know how good she is in the air. So if that's how it, like, if people sometimes criticise teams for just being able to score from set pieces, but how do you get set pieces? You create attacks, and usually it's from a keeper being forced to save, or a defender under pressure having to put the ball out. So I would never want us to get away from being an aerial threat from set pieces. But the likes of Katie McCabe, if she's in more advanced positions, you know, some people think that playing as a left wing back, it's not ideal because you want her further up the pitch. But if we are playing more on the front foot tonight, Katie McCabe's going to be in better positions. And if she gets a sniff at goal, if she's around the edge of the box, she's going to pull the trigger. So hopefully we can see something there. Yeah, eventually we will get more incisive in attack. But also as well, obviously, there's the experience, but there's pressure. It's having to deal with pressure. And we didn't deal with the pressure in Ukraine, where it was a game that you go into it knowing that if you avoid defeat, you're guaranteed a playoff. And we didn't get the job done. And subsequently, Northern Ireland held their nerve to beat Ukraine in a playoff and qualify for the Euros. If we do get a playoff, these World Cup playoffs, by the way, they're the most convoluted thing that you could...
It's a three-way mini-league, is it?
There's mini-leagues. Well, no, there's... I feel like we're going down the Nations League route here. I'm very conscious of it. But basically, yeah, if you finish as one of the runners-up, if you're one of the best ones, you go through to round two of the playoffs, and then the other six go into round one of the playoffs. This is all within Europe. But even if you win your European final playoff, if you're three of those teams, only the top two ranked through their qualifying go in, then the third one goes into this inter-confederation playoff, which is a tournament in Australia and New Zealand.
Oh, right. So, like a repechage.
Yeah, I think it's safe to just say, oh, we could qualify for the playoffs. And look, if we do that, which would be great, we'll worry about how to get there after. But
the thing to do is we actually need to win all our games from here on out and maybe draw in Sweden. And that should make us one of the top qualified teams into the playoff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I said at the time as well, with the defeat to Sweden, the fact that it was only 1-0, that would stand to us in terms of goal difference as well. So if we could beat Finland here as well, obviously that would be a huge result. I suppose we're not really in that, we don't have that luxury where we can talk about beating teams like Finland with ease. Even if we drew with them, the fact that we beat them there last month means we'd still finish ahead of them, provided we do a double over Slovakia and Georgia. So look, it's exciting times. And even on the way into work this morning, you're seeing the billboards all around. And yeah, like, crowd of over 6,000. Eventually where this is going is we get a women's international at the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, and the full house and the amazing atmosphere in Tala is actually really important. We did see that in the Luxembourg game. The small, properly populated, with a very dedicated crowd is a brilliant thing, and it could be a real fortress for us, and maybe they play glamour friendlies in the Aviva or something, I don't know, but certainly that's worth considering, as opposed to just immediately going to the Aviva when it's like a crowd of 15,000 or 12,000. It might look like it's not very many people there, when actually it's a brilliant achievement. So there's definitely a balancing act to be read there. Give us your prediction, Phil.
I think I'm going to go 2-0 Ireland.
Right, we would definitely take that. Phil, good stuff. Thanks a million for that. Now, speaking of Katie McCabe, she's part of our latest roadshow. If you're an Arsenal fan, if you're an Ireland fan, then you don't want to miss our next Cadbury FC roadshow. Robert Pires, one of the Invincibles, Ireland captain and Gunner star Katie McCabe, and Gerry Flannery, who of course is now part of the Harlequins coaching ticket, but he was a strength and conditioning coach in the senior academy at Arsenal for a year, and has brilliant stories about what it's actually like to be there and the sort of work that they do. He's worked with some pretty famous players along the way as well. It's all thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs. Coming soon to OTB Sports social channels, we have Ireland. Nathan is on duty, on commentary duty tonight, and I was just checking with him on WhatsApp. It is Emma Byrne. So I was like, is it Emma Byrne on tonight? Yeah. Libelous comments about Gareth Brooks. He misspells deliberately Garth Brooks as Gareth, as like to throw us off.
So that's a smooth move.
And then I went, are you in the queue? Blue ticked, no answer.
No, of course he is.
No time.
He is one of the 90,511 people ahead of me.
Oh, you're getting closer on.
Yeah. Shane Hannon not coming back to me on that. Look, Shane, we love you either way. You're totally entitled to do it. You just be your best self, Shane. That's all that we're asking for. Tomorrow morning at OTBAM, Adrian Barry's back in the hot seat. We're not going to be here. He's going to be joined in the studio by our special guest co-host, Hannah Tyrrell, current Dublin All-Star, recently retired Irish rugby star. We'll chat with Ronan O'Gara, Stephanie Roach, and much more as well. Be sure to tune in, as I said tonight, Nathan and Emma Byrne, Ireland against Slovakia. Kickoff is 7 o'clock and we'll bring you every minute.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.